bring the environment, or the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Policy Committee to order. Representative Anzel, can you move the minutes?
So moved.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, minutes are adopted. Okay, we're going to start with House File 3516. The chair will move House File 3516. It's a Hackbarth bill, and it's off-road vehicle registration requirements modified. And Mr. Larson, could you please come forward and explain our bill? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, Dan Larson, Minnesota Four-Wheel Drive Association. Speaking today with appreciation for yourself as author of House File 3516 and to describe the bill.
Please be brief.
This offers a second option for trail riders who may want to who may be interested in trail riding in the numerous new opportunities that will be available for off-road vehicles. Mr. Chair, it's a 30-day option as opposed to 3 years. The fee would be $20 as opposed to $30 for the 3 year. And the benefit would be easier access. You would be able to purchase these at the same places you receive or that you could purchase fishing license and hunting license, retail outlets.
Okay, thank you very much. And we have an amendment, the A1 amendment.
We do.
And the chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I like. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, this bill is, I like it because the situation is that, take Gilbert, for example. You're familiar with Gilbert and the off-road highway recreation area up there, and we've got ATVs and motorcycles and off-road trucks, and it's a great place for off-road trucks. And if you're driving a Jeep and you want to go off-roading when you're up in Gilbert, you can buy this 30-day pass, and you don't have to register your vehicle as an off-road vehicle. You can just get this 30-day pass and go to Gilbert and recreate. So I think it's a good thing to do, and it might bring some money into the account as well. Any other questions, members? Anyone in the audience? Mr. Meyer, did you want to speak to this? Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Looking at your agenda, I should probably just stay right here. But we do support the bill. The amendment that you put on there deals with our timing of the programming, and we'll work to make sure that things get done and those costs get covered. So,
very good. Any additional questions, members? Okay, the chair will move that House File 3516 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance as amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The bill is moving on.
Thank you, Mr.
Environment Finance. Thank you. Next on the agenda, House File 3002, Neuberger. Welcome to the committee. Please state you. Oh, Representative Neuberger, I will move your bill, House File 3002, to bring the bill before the committee. And we're going to be moving it on to the Environment Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3002 came to me. This is a constituent-driven bill. I'm just looking to help out farmers a little bit here. This came to light through many discussions that I've had with folks in my district and also from a very large outdoor sportsman's club within my district that's got several hundred members. I'm just going to share, the best way to do this is just to share a short discourse that I had. But basically what 3002 does, members, is it allows farmers to take one deer on their land. That's it. That's it in a nutshell. I'll be brief here. It says this year, Representative Neuberger, this year the DNR did not, again, appreciate the resources that farmers provide to help maintain the habitat for the deer population in Minnesota. In years past, when there was a lottery, landowners could still get a landowner permit It's like a slap in the face to those of us who see our crops being eaten by the deer and then have the DNR eliminate the permits. Even a buck permit is better than no permit. I understand the need to maintain a strong herd, but some consideration should be made or given to those of us who farm, as a result provide food and cover for the deer herd in central and southern Minnesota. In the past, I'd gotten my permit and had been allowed to hunt, had allowed hunting on land, my land by others, but not this year. I know that many farmers in this area feel the same way. Members, I want you to kind of catch that real quick because I know it's easy to blur. He said here that, you know, he didn't get a permit to hunt his own land, so he figures, hey, you know, why should I let other people hunt on my land? So he's restricting if I can't get a permit. He said, not this year. He says, yeah, you are on this committee. I appreciate your help. Our ongoing discourse was basically that much. That's his concern. And then I asked him to kind of quantify this for me a little bit. And he basically says here, he says he thinks that this is just one of the many examples that I've had over the since last fall, since deer season. He says, I think that many of the farmers should be able to get a deer permit regardless if they live in a lottery zone or not. He said, as I said, this year my land was in lottery zone 222, and no landowner permits were given out in any of the lottery zones. Most of the deer in the southern two-thirds of western Minnesota feed on farmland, and I think that getting a permit is not a big loss in the licensing in a license fee, and it certainly doesn't compensate most farmers for the loss of crop sustained due to feeding the deer herd. He said he has 120 acres of woods. He keeps a wildlife habitat, but then he also has several, at least twice that of tillable land that he works. Simply put, from the beginning of the year to the end of the season, the deer herd thins out at least three rows of beans. If you were to calculate it all together, he puts it at about 3 acres of beans that the deer eat. So the point being is, members, is that farmers are protecting or feeding this resource, the deer that we enjoy, that we like to hunt, and they're actually really, you know, really contributing to the sport. So what we're just trying to do here, what my bill says is that if you're a farmer, that you should, I quantified that the farmer is that if you have more than 80 acres, you have to be involved in a agriculture has to be your primary means of making a living, and it has to be more than 80 acres, because we were concerned that, okay, what if someone's got 20 acres and they call themselves a farmer, but it's really a hobby farm? That's not what we're aiming at. We're actually aiming at people that grow crops and let deer eat their what they grow. It helps the herd. But if you're a farmer, then you should be entitled to at least take one deer on your land. I think that's only fair considering the farmers that do that. I have had a brief conversation with some of the folks from the DNR here. There was some registration concerns. I think that I am more than happy to work with the DNR to come up with a solution on that. And that's it, members.
Okay. Questions for Representative Neuberger? Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question, it's a comment. I appreciate that, you know, the fact that people can have crop losses, but this bill isn't about that, because there's nothing about in here about demonstrating crop losses. So it has no connection specifically to crop losses. We have in Minnesota, I voted for it, a constitutional right to hunt, fish, and trap. And that's an individual right, it's not a property right. And this bill is setting up special privileges granted on the basis of land ownership, and not only just the fact of land ownership, but on how much land you own. So my 10 acres I've got isn't enough, and that's a slippery slope. We all share this constitutional right to hunt, trap, and fish. There are other means by which farmers could minimize their crop losses. Couple of well-trained dogs would actually go a long way toward it. So I object to it on that basis. It's not one deer, because it is available not only to the landowner but to their family members who live there. That could be a number of adults who could be eligible. And like I said, I think this is a slippery slope. We see elsewhere we're going to have bills trying to limit state ownership of public lands. We've seen an attempt previously to force the state to sell off public lands that had been donated by the original landowners for the express purpose of creating parks. We see attempts to privatize this and privatize that. This is one of those bills to put the rights that we all share in the hands of people on the basis of what they own. This country is founded on personal rights, not land ownership rights. Back in the days of King John and the Sheriff of Nottingham and all of that in England, the people weren't allowed to hunt on lands that were owned privately. And it was a big hardship for them. That might have been a big hardship for my grandfather, who fed his family off a lot of fish and deer that he got himself. It's one of the things that led to the Magna Carta. So I think this is a big thing. And I appreciate the crop loss part of it, but that's not in the bill. It's not addressed in the bill in any way. What we see in the bill is a special privilege for people that own a certain amount of a certain type of land. And I think it's a terrible precedence for us to set. And, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I didn't. What's the motion on this?
We're going to be moving it to the Environment Finance Committee.
Okay, could I have a roll call on it, please?
Sure. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neuber, thank you for bringing this forward. As a former farmer and having a family farm that is pushing being a century farm, and we have a number of century farms in my community, and a number of former century farms in my community that are not owned by the state. We have a lot of farmers out there that would like to go deer hunting, and some of the areas like yours that were unable to because they didn't, were unable to get a license because of the limited number of licenses given to a certain to that area. One thing you got to remember, because I remember reading this in the in the guidebook, how the landowners were able to obtain that permit. They had to allow other people to hunt on their land. They didn't have the right to say, no, you cannot hunt on here. They opened their land up to the public. Without this, now they're shutting that land down so the public cannot hunt on their property. Because it is private property. It's individually owned by that owner. He does not have, if he doesn't want other people to get a, to be able to hunt on his land, he would have to go buy their license the normal way. And I have a number of farmers in my community, they're concerned about damage people do trespassing on their property and the liability issues allowing them on their property that they do not use this process. But I think this something like this should be available to them should they choose to open their land up to the public for hunting of these animals. And it's a great sport that I would love to see more people get involved with because it's a tradition and such a learning experience for our kids. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Mr. Cornicelli.
Mr. Chair, members, I wanted to run through a real brief presentation about kind of the lottery
system. Please state your name and who you represent.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I should know that. Lou Cornicelli, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, Wildlife Research Manager. I was told to go fast, so I skipped some things.
Faster, go the better.
appreciate Representative Neuberg's thoughts on talking about how this bill will be framed. I kind of put this together in the context of what system we had available today. So you've all seen the bill. I picked out a couple of things that have already been mentioned, the 80 acres of ag land for the owner and the family members. Also, the qualifying land can be non-contiguous, and the permit or license is actually in the permit area, not just the property the person owns. So there's a couple things in there that are different than some other rules that we have related to landowner preference. We do have a couple of species where we do have a landowner preference drawing. One is elk. You need 160 acres, have to live in the zone. We only have 20 landowner applications last year, and we rejected 17 of them. That's easy to check, 20. Turkey is 40 acres of non-contiguous land of any land type. You have to live on the property, and you also have to allow public hunting. If you win the lottery, you're actually published on a list on our website. When we had most areas lottery, we had about 2,000, give or take, landowner applications. When law enforcement was doing a real thorough review back in the day when this was relatively new, it took about 2 weeks to go through those 2,000 people. A cursory review is much quicker. In other words, just looking at, you live in Egan, you're putting in for a permit area and brain or drought. That's kind of a cursory review. The fact that we publish the list is kind of a disincentive for cheating, because they know if they draw, their name's going to be out there, and if they don't actually own land, that's kind of a self-correcting. This doesn't apply in this case. For deer, it kind of gets supersized. As you know, we've been under pretty intense pressure to raise deer populations, and we're doing that. Last year, 2015, about half the state was lottery, so that would apply. A lot of the state was bucks only. I would guess we might see some more lottery areas this year. We had 33,000 permits. We have a 500,000 deer hunters as opposed to 20,000 or 40,000 turkey hunters. We had 100,000 applications for lottery permits last year. We know from our surveys of landowners and deer hunters, about half of our landowners hunt, and that's higher in rural areas. About 60% of people who respond to our landowner hunter surveys at least do some of their hunting on their own private land. So a lot of people hunt their own land. As part of our deer goal setting, hunter attitude, landowner attitude surveys, I just picked out basically the pheasant range, which is kind of a lot of our lottery permit areas in the southwest, and I was able to find 27,000 parcels of 80 acres or greater just in the pheasant range. That doesn't include most of the northern part of the state. My best guess is probably 10,000 plus landowner applications that we'd receive with the way this is written. So what I thought was important is to kind of lay out the timeline of how we manage the deer season. The regulation book comes out in late July. We start selling deer licenses on August 1st. We might be able to kick that back to the last week in July, likely no earlier than that. Our lottery application deadline is the Thursday after Labor Day. It's been that way since 1977. So this year it's September 8th. This year we'll likely get the lottery file on September 12th. Again, 100,000 applications last year. That file goes through a ton of steps. We have to attach the lottery preference from your previous application. We have to manually add military preference. We have to allocate the firearm and muzzleloader proportions based on how people applied. We have to then reset all the quotas to match the drawing for the muzzleloader versus firearm. Then we check it, about three people check it over the course of several days to make sure we don't make any mistakes. 127 permit areas, thousands of permits, it takes a bit to check all that stuff. We then run the lottery, check the files again, and notify the winners, both web and mail. That takes up to 3 weeks to do, just with the system that we have right now. The leftover permits by rule are available the second Monday in October. We don't have a lot of them, so that's not a big deal. And then the deer season opens the Saturday nearest November 6th, and this year that's going to be November 5th. So we don't have a lot of time. So the challenges, as written, is that compressed timeline to review those applications. The notifications, in our best estimation, you're going to get your postcard that you got a permit just before the deer season if you're lucky. The compliance checks are actually done by law enforcement. And that does take the officers out of the field just before deer season checking parcels. There's no way to check non-contiguous ag parcels electronically. There's really no way to check parcels electronically. Not all the counties have their parcel data digitized. And even those that do, there's often a lag. So we wouldn't be able to just go online and check landowners. So the compliance, The fiscal note that we developed is really for a cursory review. In other words, when the application comes in, do you live in the permit area that you applied for? That wouldn't take all that much time. But given the level of oversight in the deer program right now, especially related with the audit and then the desire to increase deer numbers, our concern that's not appropriate to do a cursory review. We'd end up dealing with at least two situations where a person gets a permit where they shouldn't have and a person who doesn't get a permit when they should have. And there's really no time to fix that. There's also two separate checks, one firearm, one muzzleloader, because we have two lotteries. The special hunts, we just have a deer lottery. We don't have a Zone 1 lottery, Zone 2. So we would have to wait until this is over to run our final lottery. And our special hunt applicants, like St. the Parks, they like to know earlier than a week before deer season if they can go on their hunt. So that would complicate it a bit. If we went through a real thorough electronic evaluation or had to do any reprogramming of our computer system, it's going to be way more expensive and way more time-consuming. So the take-home is we can flip a switch and make everybody declare whether or not they're a landowner, but we won't be able to really do any kind of vetting in the time period that we have available. So that's
thank you.
Hopefully I went not too long.
Members, I'd like to pass this out of here and pass it on to the Environment Finance Committee today, and I think Representative Neuberger might require a little work with the DNR to make it a little bit of a better bill. If you don't mind doing that before it gets to a hearing in Representative McNamara's committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, if I could, just briefly. Very briefly, this is not a land ownership issue. This is about the farmers being able to hunt their own land, period. What incentive is there for them to allow the herds on their lands to eat the crops that they grow? They're feeding our state deer herd if they're not even allowed to take one. So I think that Representative Yarusso, although I appreciate her intent, I think that she's probably needs to look at that a little closer. I'm more than happy to work with the DNR on this, and I think a simple online registration program like we did with the cottage food industry would suffice. Again, members, I appreciate your support, and I just want to reach out and help the farmers. That's all we're doing.
All in favor of House File 30. Oh, I'm sorry, there is a roll call. Clerk will call the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Lewick.
Aye.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative Anzels.
Aye.
Representative Considine. Representative Cornish.
Aye.
Representative Eklund.
Aye.
Representative Hertz. Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Keel.
Aye.
Representative Lucero.
Aye.
Representative McNamara. Representative Moline. Representative Metza. Representative Yarusso.
No.
There being 9 ayes and 1 nay, the motion prevails, and House File 3002 is passed and re-referred to the Committee on Environment Finance.
Thank you, members. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Next on the agenda, Representative Anzell. Representative Anzell moves House File 3304. Representative Anzell has an amendment, and it's the DE1 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he'd like. All in favor of that motion to adopt the DE1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Two-year bill is amended, Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know you've been waiting patiently all day for this hearing so we could discuss crows.
I like this bill.
Okay, very good. What we're doing here is setting the season from July 15th to October 31st. Frankly, the idea came to me from several constituents of mine who live in places up north, Big Fork, Northome, Grand Rapids, and Deer River. And they complained that today it's too cold to hunt crows in December and January, and it interferes with ice fishing, and the crows are gone. And they seem to think that their sport will be better served, and they'll have more fun. There'll be more shooting, more opportunities to hone their shooting skills. And so I We'll stand for questions about crows.
Questions for Representative Anzell. I don't see any questions. Anyone from the DNR like to speak? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Thank you, Chairman, members. My name is Pat Rivers, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. Our current crow season provides the maximum number of days that can be hunted allowed by federal law. And the current season used public input process, including talking with the city of Rochester. As you might know, they have an issue with crows in late December, early January. And this late season has been effective in trying to help them haze those birds away from the city and Mayo Clinic. The winter season, again, was at the request of Rochester, and it's a very effective time to hunt. One of our crow hunters here in the metro area claims that the July and August time period here in the metro is hot and is not conducive to crow hunting. So we've tried to do our best to make that crow season work for our hunters and also our constituents in Rochester.
Questions? Mr. Rivers? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Anzell, any further?
Just a brief comment, Mr.
Sure.
Chair. I would hope that we don't have to pit one community against the rest of the state or one region of the state against the other regions of the state. We certainly should be able to get along here and shoot a few crows.
Sure, and if there's anything that we can do to make things a little bit better, we can address that on the floor, too.
Right.
Okay. Representative Anzell's motion is to pass the bill and re-refer to the General Register. All in favor of that motion, as amended. As amended. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. Bill's on the General Register.
Thank you.
Okay, next on the list, we have Representative Hackbarth is going to do his game and fish bill. And we have a delete all amendment for that. I will move House File 2844 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. And I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I like. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Members, this is a number of bills that we've heard in this committee that we put together. It's some of the DNR language. We took some of the DNR language out. And it includes the crow bill and includes a number of other issues as well. One thing that you might want to pay attention to is Section 36 on page 19. This is new. It's not been a bill. You probably heard recently that the DNR made a decision on Mille Lacs Lake to not allow any walleye be taken this season. And I think there's a lot of people that don't agree with that. I think there's some legislation over in the Senate that's quite different from this. But what this does is say that until it allows for one trophy walleye to be taken until we reach the maximum amount that was agreed to with the tribes this year. So that's pretty simple and straightforward. And I think that would at least allow for the opening of walleye season for folks to fish walleyes up on Mille Lacs and maybe for a few weeks after that. So a couple other things in here. We've got the David Dill Trail. There's a couple of other things that probably are not game and fish related, but they are DNR related, and it's probably going to turn into sort of a DNR policy bill. So with that, any discussion or questions? Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Mr.
Now, could you walk through the bill just very briefly, just maybe section by section, and we can go pretty quick. If people have questions, they can stop us.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members, on the DE2, the first section is from Representative Fabian's Elk bill. This is the language as it was in the amendment that was adopted. Section 2 is new language. This would exempt the DNR from requirements to purchase ethanol-blended fuel for certain vehicles, boats, snowmobiles, and small engines. There's a state requirement that they do that for motor vehicles. Sections 3 and 4 are from the ORV pass bill that we just heard today, and that's as it was amended just now. Section 5 is the David Dill Trail language. Sections 6 and 7 are from the turkey stamp elimination bill we heard earlier. Section 8 is from House File 3206 that we heard of, probably last week, that eliminates that 50 cents of the deer license fee that goes towards wolf management. Sections 9, 10, and 11 are from the gross over-limit penalty bill that we heard, and this is as it was amended here in committee. Section 12 is another section from the turkey stamp elimination. Section 13 on page 8 is from the gross over-limit penalty bill. Section 14 is from the original DNR game and fish bill that we heard earlier. Sections 15 through 20 are from the turkey stamp elimination bill. And then section 21 is from House File 3209, the lead shot rules ban that we heard earlier. Section 22 is from the original DNR bill. Section 23, again, is from the original DNR bill. Section 24 is from the bill that clarified the hunter satisfaction survey requirements were for deer hunters, and we heard that, I think that was House File 3135. Section 25 is the Blaze Pink, from the Blaze Pink bill that we heard earlier. Section 26 is a modified version of House File 3160. This was pertaining to the night vision and thermal imaging requirement. This is a narrow exception that's specific if you look at lines 15.13 through 15.14. It's just an exception for an employee testing a firearm or ammunition. Section 27 is the landowner preference bill we just heard. Section 28 is from the original DNR bill. Section 29 is the other section from Representative Fabian's elk management bill. Section 30 is the amended language on the crow season that we just heard. Section 31 is from the original DNR bill. Section 32 is from House File 3207. That's the Muskie bill, and this is as it was amended to narrow it just to the Six Lakes. Section 33 and 34 are from the DNR's Northern Pike proposal that we heard earlier. Section 35 is another section on the Blaze Pink. Section 36 is the walleye regulations that the chair just mentioned. Section 37 is the appropriation for the David Dill Trail. And then Section 38 is a repealer that was from the turkey stamp elimination bill.
Thank you very much. Good job. Questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Urosa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the section about the Blaze Pink, the other day I asked a question about whether there was evidence that it's visible enough for people with color blindness, and since then I've learned that there's a definition in the DNR for blaze orange. Do we have actual specifications for what this would mean, or would we expect the DNR to develop that? But mainly I'm concerned at right this minute, did you get an answer about the color blindness?
Representative Russo, I did not get an answer on that. We tried to reach this person, and we did not get that information. I apologize. But, yeah, the DNR would have to make rules for that, and we're requesting that.
So, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative Russo.
I have some big concerns about that, because the use of blaze orange really helped reduce our hunting deaths, and I would hate to see any tragedy happen because we succumb to a marketing effort. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. First, let me thank you for containing the provisions that are in the bill, that are in the department's bill. There are a number of provisions that we have testified against on this, in this bill, which I'm not going to go into at this point in time. But I would like to just bring to your attention sections 9, 10, and 11 that deal with the DNR sections dealing with prosecuting attorneys, and then the gross over limits language. We have worked on this language, and we have some amended language that I believe needs to be heard in Representative Cornish's committee. This language is on the Senate floor as our separate enforcement bill. So, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure if you would be moving this bill to Representative Cornish's bill, or with the intention that we can fix the language in his committee on the standalone bill and bring it back into this bill. But I just wanted to bring that to the committee's attention for sure, and then answer any questions people might have on specific sections.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Anderson, you want to move that amendment? Do you have an amendment to the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Yes, I found a technical item here on page 17, line 8. I'm sorry, line 17.8, where it says Gull Chain of Lakes in Cass County. It should be added Cass and Crow Wing County, because the northern part of the lake and part of the chain is in Crow Wing. Otherwise, you know, somebody might be able to throw a couple of muskies over on the Crow Wing side, and they might
swim over to the
swim over.
Other Ms. Taylor, do you have the amendment?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, the amendment would read on line 17.8, after county, insert and Crow Wing County.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just have
Mr. Meyer.
One more comment. On section 36, dealing with the 1 over 28 until the quota is met. Well, this wouldn't impact the year class we're trying to protect with the current rule or the proposed rule. One of our main concerns in establishing the season parameters this year was not to have to face that closure terminology or having the lake closed to fishing. So now with this language, and I can come back and address this probably in the finance committee, I would assume there's a probably pretty good likelihood that we would have to close the lake entirely to all walleye fishing rather than allow catch and release. So it's something that I think the department would want to have ongoing conversations with you as this language moves forward as to how we set our seasons and what we're looking for. I know there was a lot of concern about actually closing the season or sending out that message that the season is closed, and that's why we were doing catch and release only. So I just want to reserve that right to continue those conversations with you, Mr. Chairman.
Very good. Any further discussion? The chair renews his motion that House File 2844 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Policy, and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails.
One, excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Representative Urissa.
No.
Oh, we got it. Okay. Motion prevails. The bill is moved to the Environment Policy and Finance Committee. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Ugo. The chair will move House File 2961 to bring it before the committee, and we will be moving the bill to the Environment Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, there is an amendment. I don't know if you received the A-16.
Mm-hmm. Representative Uglum moves the A-16-0966 amendment to get the bill in the shape that he likes. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted.
Thank you,
bill as amended, Representative Uglum.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2961 is a pretty simple bill, really. It has to do with veterans, disabled American veterans, and also it provides for current active military, reserve, and National Guard and their dependents to receive free annual passes to the Minnesota State Parks. The bill does restrict the use of the annual park permit to vehicles owned and occupied by the person who has issued the permit. So I stand for questions. It's a simple bill. We're trying here to provide a little benefit for our disabled American vets and our active military personnel.
Questions for Representative Uglum? Representative Urissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Trying to read quickly. So would this include members of the National Guard from other states who are not currently stationed here?
Representative Uglum.
Yes, it would. Members of the National Guard, it says. So, yes, I believe it would.
Representative Urissa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I totally understand, you know, for our active members of the service, the people that live in our state, stationed in our state and whatnot.
Representative Urissa, it says State National Guard. I'm sorry.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Does that then, so I'm not really familiar with the exact terminology, does that then imply Minnesota somehow?
Representative Ulam.
That is the intent of the bill. We can clean it up if you want in the next committee stop, but the State National Guard is the Minnesota National Guard, yes.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, I would leave that to the experts on the research staff, and maybe that needs to reference the definition of that somewhere else. Thank you.
Ms. Taylor, do you have any suggestion on that? Or?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe it's clear that it's Minnesota under this, but I can check with our analyst who works on...
Very good, and we'll do that, and we'll make that change in the Finance Committee if that needs to be done. You're committed to that, Representative Ulam?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Again, please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This is very similar to a bill that Representative Purcell has and has actually heard in committee as well, except this actually expands the concept to include the intent will be Minnesota Reserve or Minnesota National Guard. And it's language that we've been working on. It was actually introduced last session, parts of it were, to actually streamline some of our operations rather than issue a daily permit. We thought, let's try to issue an annual permit where possible and then hopefully get these people back into the parks more. They can use the parks rather than have to go in and get a sticker every day. Perhaps make some more money, firewood, camping, things like that. So we do support the concepts. And some of the fiscal issues we need to work through, just some of the numbers are unknown what those are. But I know this will be going to Environment Finance, which we can have that discussion at that point in time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Any further questions, members? Okay. The chair will renew his motion that House File 2961 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Appreciate it.
Oh, Representative McNamara, can we take you next?
Sure.
We're going to go a little bit out of order. Representative McNamara moves House File 3501.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And we're going to move the bill right to the General Register? Or no? Okay.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
I had to think for a second. Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 3501 to be passed and moved on to the General Register.
And you have an amendment that you'd like to offer the A16-0980 to get it in the shape you like?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Two-year bill is amended.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Mr. Vandalin introduce himself, and he could explain the bill.
Mr. Vandalin.
Mr. Chair, members, Aaron Vandalin, School Trust Lands Director. It's a pretty straightforward bill. It's a modification to the Minerals Management Account. Currently, the Mineral Management Account has a $3 million cap at the end of every fiscal year. The amount over $3 million is swept and refunded back to the mineral owners, the mineral owners being the school trust, the university trust, and the tax forfeited trust. The reason we're asking for quarterly sweeps and refunds to the mineral owners is due to the balance of the account over the last two bienniums. The balance for the school trust alone has been refunded $4.5 million. That $4.5 million is earning less than 1% interest annually. If it was deposited and invested by the State Board of Investment, we're looking at about a 7.5% return. So pretty straightforward, just looking to get more interest and more money deposited into the school trust fund.
Okay, very good. Questions, members? Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm afraid I didn't really have time to raise this while looking at the amendment, while we were voting on it. Sorry, I didn't look at it ahead of time. The amendment really kind of takes us out of the range of what we deal with on this committee, the provision to seek judicial review of a ruling. And so I'm kind of questioning sending it straight to the General Register without sending it to Judiciary so they can take a look at that, because I have, I have little means to assess what the implications of this are, and I strongly suspect this has quite broader implications than the rest of the content of the bill. So would you consider amending where you're going to send this and send it on to Judiciary?
Representative Russo, we've checked with all the committees that might have jurisdiction in this area, and they said that it's just clarifying language, so it doesn't need to go to those committees. We thought maybe it might have to go to GovOps. We thought maybe it might have to go to Public Safety. And we checked with those chairs and their committee administrators, and they said we could just send it to the General Register.
In that case, could I have staff explain to me what under Sections 14.63 to 14.69 entails?
Ms. Taylor, can you help us with that?
Mr. Chair, members, I would need to consult with the statutes.
Okay.
Mr. Representative, we could buy some time if you took a question from Representative Anzell. Okay. Ms. Taylor did so.
Representative Anzell.
I saw his hand go up, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the author, Representative McNamara. Members, once again, this is really straightforward. Once again, this is the people of the Iron Range in northeastern Minnesota sharing what little wealth they have to help you in every school district, in every community of Minnesota. They are helping to educate every school child to the tune of about $28 a year, every year. And this legislation puts just a little bit more of that wealth into that account so that the good people of the Iron Range can continue to share with you what little wealth they have and to help to educate your kids. So you should vote for this without any objection.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have been delighted to have had the opportunity to have done just that, Representative Ansells. But I do not have the opportunity to do that because we've had this amendment tacked on to this thing that's about the account and what you talk about and where that money goes and the good purposes that goes to. And we've had something completely different tacked on to it that has broad-reaching impact. We have major permitting operations in front of us with the DNR and the MPCA that this potentially has an impact on. And so to put it onto this other bill that should be a beautifully clean bill that can do exactly what you just said is the sort of thing we should not be doing. We should not be tacking something on about judicial review onto a thing that's about the minerals management account. It's in the same section of law, so you're permitted to do it. But this is the sort of thing that causes well-intended things that we can all go along with, like these schools accounts, to get messed up and to make people suspicious. It's the kind of sleight of hand that is the worst way we do business. They were tacking this thing on about the judicial ruling, review of decisions on permits, onto something that's about the school funds from the minerals account. And I don't appreciate it. And so my job here is to make sure I understand what the full impact of that thing that's been tacked onto this now and is going to go to the floor this way. It is my job to make sure I understand fully what the implications of that are. And so, yes, I do get to have an objection to this bill. It has nothing to do with the schools fund. I am fully in support of the schools fund aspect of this. I totally understand what that mineral management account is about and how much good it has done for the range. I see the high schools. I see the facilities. I know that the kids benefit from it a lot. I have no objection to that. But it does not mean that I have an objection to that if I have an objection to what we're tacking onto it. Now, unfortunately, yes, I should have jumped in and asked that question before the vote went by me. But I'm asking it now. And I'm expecting to get some more explanation of it. I know we will because they're working on it. But I have great qualms about the method. The method itself makes me suspect. The method of attaching this thing about the judicial review to the thing that's about the limits on the minerals management account raises my hackles. I find it unacceptable behavior, and I'm not going to let it just slide by me.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify, we adopted the A16 to get the bill in the shape the author would like, mm-hmm. and everybody's free to vote yes or no on the bill, but I was just trying to get the bill in the shape I wanted to present it, and that's pretty standard procedure in your committee and my committee. That
and now we're discussing
that.
It.
Yeah.
Now it's up for debate.
Mr. Chair, I think Ms. Taylor might be able to shed some light, and then Commissioner Meyer could add, too.
Ms. Taylor?
Mr. Chair, members, this is out of my area of expertise, but the statutes that it is referencing is the process used for the judicial review of contested cases, and that's just a procedure that is outlined in statute. And that.
Mr. Meyer, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chair, members, yes, Janelle and Ms. Taylor is right. Sorry. Looking at these sections, these sections 14.6 through 14.69 just basically state that the Court of Appeals is the venue for appeals and decisions under this chapter for these permits of mine. So I guess in looking at this, rather than all you're doing is, rather than keeping the language may appeal such order, ruling, or decision in the manner provided in Chapter 14, you're just clarifying that it's going to be under 14.6369 in the appellate courts. I do need to say this isn't a department amendment, but I'm just here to provide the way that we're seeing it right now.
Ms. Jensen, would you please state your name and who you represent for the record and give us a brief explanation?
Sure. I'm Kelsey Johnson. I'm president of the Iron Mining Association. And actually, what we're trying to do here is just simply reiterate that what is required when there is an appeal on a permit, kind of how the process should work. So currently with the DNR, we have gone through a judicial review. As it states in the Chapter 14 guidelines, there are three options. There's agency rulemaking, procedures for contested cases before the Office of Administrative Hearings, and finally a procedure for judicial review for the appellate courts. So we would like all parties that are involved to basically be on the same page, and that's what we're asking for here.
Representative Urizel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm satisfied for the moment. I'm going to have to do some more research on this, but that's really kind of what I'm objecting to, is that we're sitting in a committee where we do not have the expertise to literally know what we're dealing with here, and it's being amended onto a bill making distributions quarterly for the minerals management account. So I know that that's common practice. It's not common practice that I like.
Representative Enzo.
Members, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, what the legislation is intending to do is to maximize money from 16 and 36 sections which go into the minerals account from the extraction of minerals on the Mesabi Iron Range confined to iron ore mining. Please don't feel that there's any sleight of hand here, that there's any dastardly plot by Representative McNamara or anyone else to get us into the morass of non-ferrous mineral management. This is a good bill.
Thank you, Representative Anzal. And Representative Urizel, if you have anybody to blame, it's me. This was brought to me and I gave my approval. We checked with the various committees and they gave their approval to move forward with it. And I tried to do my best diligence, and I still think it's a good and the right thing to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I know we haven't asked for a voice vote on this, and I'm not going to. I just like clarify my intent. I'm just going to abstain on this one until I find out more. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Johnson. Pass. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative McNamara, for bringing the bill forward, and to Mr. Vandalindi for being a fiduciary. That's in its true full spirit of what a fiduciary is supposed to do. It's supposed to maximize return on investment for the schools. And lastly, Representative Anzal, I just wanted to clarify something you said. And thank you to all your constituents, the hard work on their back, the mining extraction. But you said that all of the $28 was from mining with regard to the schools. And the $28 per student is $28 million of return on investment in the total school trust fund. Some of that is interest and other investment earnings. It's not entirely from the mining. The principal in the trust account is from mining and from timber and from other school trust land stuff, but the 28 bucks isn't solely mining, just to clarify that.
Thank you.
Representative Cornish.
Just real quickly, members, this amendment was passed by me, and I see no reason to bring it to the Judiciary Committee because it doesn't cause them to do anything they wouldn't normally do in their work course or increase fiscal note any, so I don't have any problem with it.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to put a little finer touch on that point that Representative Hertaus and Representative Ansel have made about the corpus of that trust fund is about 85-90% derived from minerals, so that we're going to divide that up to, you know, 26-28 bucks times 90% comes from mining, and then a much smaller part from the corpus. Anyway, the message here is that this needs to be done to maximize the return on investment, and make no mistake, 90% of that corpus is directly related to the mineral rights and not the timber.
Okay, any further comments? Representative McNamara renews his motion that House File 3501 be recommended pass and be placed on the General Register as amended. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is on the General Register. Representative Keel, we skipped over you. You had to leave for something earlier, so... Representative Keel moves House File 2946 to bring it before the committee. Let's see, where are we sending your bill? Environment, Finance, and Policy. Any amendments, Representative Keel?
No, there is not.
Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. A while ago, a mother emailed me and said, "My sons serve in the Minnesota National Guard. I don't understand why they have to pay a license because they live in another state. They serve in Minnesota but reside in another state because of their jobs." And she wanted to know why they could not purchase a Minnesota fishing and game license. So we did some research and found out that, yes, you can't in Minnesota, but this bill brings forward the opportunity for our people who serve in the Minnesota National Guard to be able to purchase a Minnesota hunting and or fishing license. That's the basics of the bill. Oh, and I did ask for a fiscal note. It is not ready yet. So.
Okay, hopefully that'll happen before we get it to the next committee.
Should be tomorrow.
Okay. Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, we do support this bill. Currently, if you're a non-resident student, you could buy a resident fishing license. Just on the fiscal note, we have no idea how many people this is going to impact, so I don't expect a lot of information in the fiscal note is what I'm trying to say. So I think it's the right thing to do, and we're willing to figure out the impacts of it. So
that's good to hear. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just, as this bill goes forward, I'm wondering if... I don't know if DNR has a comment or a possibility, but sometimes, Mr. Chair, we have reciprocity agreements as part of this, and I'm wondering if the Minnesota residents that live in Minnesota and maybe work at the Air Force Base in North Dakota, is there a potential that we could tie that we'd like North Dakota to do what we're doing, and if that could just be investigated between now and when it gets to the next committee?
Mr. Meyer, we can do that, at least investigate that possibility.
Thank you, Chairman. Yes, sir.
Thank you. Questions, members? Seeing none, Representative Keel renews her motion that House File 2946 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Environment, Natural Resources, Policy, and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, motion prevails. It's on the way to the Finance Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Eklund. Moving right along. Boy, I like this day. Representative Eklund moves House File 3634 to bring it before the committee, and we're going to be moving your bill to the Environment Finance Committee as well. Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I promise this won't take long. This came up from a constituent that was had some concerns about payments of it, of his lease around the Vermilion Sudan Mine State Park. They introduced the bill on their behalf. Since then, Mr. Myers had some chat with me, and I understand that there is some significant concern for the DNR, and I'm willing to work through those concerns with him. And with that, I'll let Mr. Meyer comment.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you. For the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. And many of you probably are familiar with the Sudan boathouses, but if you're not, they are a historical area. They're very beautiful. They're very old. It's an issue we've been dealing with for quite some time. The last time it came up, we allowed them to be transferred, as you can see in the bill, the stricken language, to the third degree of kindred or first cousin according to civil law. So now the bill before you will perpetuate indefinitely the private use of a public resource. It will also allow sale of these individual units on the open market. It's going to create some workload issues for us that I'll address about the fiscal impact here shortly, but creating these workloads for lease transfers, new boathouse owners will bring increased expectations for services at the boathouse down there, amenities, bathrooms, picnic areas, things like that. These boathouses are already undersized, and the trend on Lake Vermilion in particular is moving to larger boats. And there's been the no-fee leases have been converted to paid leases in conformance with existing law right now. What this bill would provide for is you'll see the lease. It allows for the transfer sale, and it also provides the lease to be one-third of the average market rate based on comparable private lease rates. So now we're in direct competition at a severely lower rate than with the private renters or sellers of these boathouses that are out there right now. And also on line 2.5, the funds go to the general fund. So currently we're generating about $75,000 a year off these leases that are used to manage the leases, to do the work down there, cut the grass, things like that. So that's one of our other impacts. I guess stripping our ability to have funding related to these leases will cause impacts to the park, further stressing our parks and trails budget, and then perpetuating indefinitely the existence of these boathouses is one of our major concerns, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Questions, members? Representative Eklund, I have some real heartburn over the bill as well. I'm going to pass the bill out of this committee today, hopefully, if everybody agrees with me. I want to pass it out of here. I think there's some real concerns with the bill. If you can work with the DNR in the meantime, I would recommend that. I don't know if we can change it to make it any better or not, but maybe we can do that before it gets to Representative McNamara, before we have to have a hearing in Representative McNamara's committee. I don't know what his opinion is on the bill. I have some issues with it and some concerns, but I want to pass it out here today, give you some time to work on it. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I agreed with Bob or Mr. Meyer to work through the issues on this.
Very good. So, members, I would recommend that we pass it out here today and let Representative Eklund work with the DNR on maybe coming up with a resolution to the issue. So, any further discussion to the bill? Representative McNamara, did you have a question? Comment? Okay. Representative Eklund renews his motion that House File 3634 pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Policy or Environment and Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Bill is on the way to Representative McNamara's committee. Representative Green. Oh. Okay, the chair will move House File 2603 to bring it before the committee. 2603. We're going to be moving the bill to the Environment Policy and Finance Committee. Representative Green, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House File 2603 is a pretty simple bill. It just requires that
DNR and Bowser to have public hearings before the purchase of any land for in fee with public money. The bill is in front of you. I can go through it if you want, but in the interest of time, I maybe
we've got a little time, so maybe you can just walk through us briefly.
Okay.
Your bill's been through civil law and data practices, and
Okay. It's just pretty much what I said. It requires DNR to have a public hearing. It spells out when they have to do it, when they have to post notices. Requires a public hearing in a convenient place, so they have to be within the county where the land is to be purchased. If there's no place within that county, then they will have to go to an adjoining county. And it's just that simple. So unless, if you have any questions, I'll gladly take them.
Questions, members?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Green, going back to my days on the county board, it seems to me that anytime there's a sale of land within a county, the county board has to have a public hearing. Isn't that sufficient?
Representative Green.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ansel, I don't think so. What has happened, and the reason this bill came forward, is because there were some property purchases in my area. There were three, to be specific, and one of them was a very substantial purchase. And the DNR holds what is called open houses for people to come, and they will be able to go from table to table, but they're not allowed to congregate and ask questions back and forth and get their questions answered. And so what happened in this particular meeting was a great number of people from my district showed up to be able to get their questions answered and to ask questions and have public input. And they started filling up the chairs in this room, and then they were informed that there's not going to be a meeting. This is just an open house. And so the folks in that came there turned it into a meeting, and then were accused of hijacking the meeting by the officials that were there. And what this is going to do is simply open it up. I don't think it's very complicated. It just requires a hearing, and the DNR then will be required to answer questions, and if they can't answer them that day, then they will have a certain amount of time to get back to the people with those answers, and they will be posting those on their websites.
Representative Anzo.
Thank you. So because of one county board's messing up a public hearing, we're going to change the law. That's what this seems to me. Back in my days on the county board, this was done routinely. The public was informed and notified and participated in public hearings conducted by the county board. And I just need to feel better about the fact that this seems duplicative.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Ansel. I don't believe that it is duplicative. I think that this is an opportunity for people to gather together and discuss the problems that they have with land purchases. As you know, Representative Ansel, we're losing an enormous amount of land in our area, and a lot of the people feel helpless, and they really want their questions answered on this, and with some other bills that I have here, too. They want to have safeguards put in place where they can stop these purchases if they feel they should be stopped, and get the answers that they require. And I think that that's what this bill does. And the county boards, and I've been to those hearings as well. They are not this kind of a format. They're a very structured format. And what you'll find in the county board is in many cases, what will happen is you'll have to pre-register if you want to ask a question. Many times you have to write that question down, and so a lot of people don't even get a chance to speak, and this will address that as well.
Anything further, Representative Ansel?
I'm fine.
Okay. Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for spending your afternoon with me today. I appreciate it. The bill in question here we have been working on with Representative Greener has taken several formats. Now it's just focusing on DNR and Bowser land acquisitions. The public meeting that Representative Green was talking about was dealing with a boat access site on Sand Lake where we had no requirement to hold a public open house or a public meeting. We wanted to provide information to citizens about what the plans were, what we were doing, and have a discussion with them. And he describes the meeting accurately. A group of individuals came in with their own design and tried to take over the meeting, and we tried to get it under control and move forward with what we were trying to do. So that's a fair representation, but I just want to make sure for the record, we weren't required to have a public meeting that. We were going above and beyond the requirements. The requirements in Chapter 97 that require the DNR to get County Board approval for wildlife management area acquisition and now scientific and natural area acquisition, we work with County Boards on a regular basis, as you described, Representative Ansel's, working with their staff, working with them so they understand what the acquisitions are. And if they deny an acquisition, we once in the past 2 decades have gone to the Land Exchange Board to try to usurp that authority. And by the time we did that, we were able to come to a resolution. So it's not a standard practice to try to roll a county. We're working with counties throughout the state trying to figure out how to consolidate land, sell land, buy land. So the need for a public hearing, I think, is met at those county board meetings, which are public meetings. They're noticed. They're there. The agendas are set forth. They're on the agenda. The bill, as it's written, does put a substantial amount of work activities onto the department, and they're going to have a substantial fiscal note. I don't know what the fiscal note says right now, but you know, just publishing in the newspaper of a general circulation area, the State Register, and on our website. So the newspaper publication, the State Register publications are actual hard numbers that we have to pay. We do between 70 and 80 transactions a year, so there's a fiscal note on that. If you go back to the next page here, the proceedings of the hearing must be recorded and available to the public for review. And then I think we have to respond. The commissioner must accept written comments, and then the commissioner must provide written responses to comments. These are the types of things we do for environmental review for PolyMet, Representative Ansel. I mean, we spend hundreds of thousands of dollars answering those questions, and I don't know how many thousands of hours of staff time answering those questions. So it's going to have some fiscal impacts that we're going to need to deal with, and I believe the department believes there is already a process to deal with land acquisition. Speaking on behalf of the Board of Water Soil Resources, who's not here today, they don't acquire land. I mean, they hold easements, so none of this would be applicable to them, but if they were to acquire land, they would have to go through the same process, and it creates what we feel is an unnecessary burden as we're having these conversations with counties and citizens already.
Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let me ask a question again a little bit about, so the circumstance that we were talking about that occurred had to do with a boat access or a public access procurement of that type of property, am I correct? The kind of the foundation of what drove this?
Representative Green?
Mr. Chair, that was one of the meetings that I was at, yes.
Okay.
And the people who came there did not come there with the idea of hijacking the meeting. They came there with the idea with proposals and to get their questions answered, and it became apparent to them that they weren't going to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Representative Lloyd.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess we had similar circumstances in the area I represent, and one comes to mind that maybe some of the folks, I don't know if Bob was involved with this or not, but when the DNR purchased a public access, another public access on Mille Lacs Lake, it was a type facility, and I do remember that there was several very public hearings where it was very formal, where it was laid out to everybody that attended what the plan was, what the cost was. There was an opportunity for people to write down questions because it just to keep order and make sure it was an orderly process about what was to take place. And if I remember in that case, because it was a very touchy subject, I believe we had two public meetings. And the reason I was involved, I was a county commissioner that represented that district, and people confused the county board's authority in other circumstances to have a say in whether land was sold or purchased. In this case, we had absolutely no say as a county board. But I will say this, that public hearing process really resolved a long-term issue. We actually, that property does belong to the DNR now, and it is another element on Mille Lacs Lake. So in that case, that's an example where that type of not a open house type approach, but a very formal public hearing process did resolve and move the ball forward on behalf of the DNR. So I'm not so keen about building up a whole lot of extra costs within the DNR's world, but that public hearing process did work in that case. I think we had another one on Farm Island Lake, another fairly large lake. Same thing, where people just really had to be satisfied that they understood what it was, you know, what was going to happen. I don't want to see us putting the extra costs that we don't have to on this, but that public hearing process, I agree with you 100%, Representative Green, that it needs to be clear, formal, and work properly to satisfy everybody's requirements.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, thank you for bringing this bill forward. It's something I believe is needed. I don't know how many have gone to county board meetings. I go to a few of them because I have two different counties in my district. Generally, they do not have public comment time. They don't have time with what they're doing. And generally, those meetings, county board meetings, are during the daytime when people are working. They don't have an opportunity to even go in to hear them. Then you have to find out if it's at the committee of the whole, which is one day, or at the regular meeting, which is another day. But the public input in these decisions is important. I have one township in my district that about one-third of that township has been taken over by the state. And it's a very much hardship on the rest of those people that live in that township. And you're just going to the county board. You're not getting the input from the people that live in the township, or the town board that have to deal with the decisions when 400 or 500 acres could be taken out of the tax roll. And payment in lieu of taxes doesn't even come close. And then it also affects the school districts, because it's money taken, tax dollars taken away, so it pushes those dollars on the other people that live in that community. So I think it's real important to have public input on these decisions, but with the people that live in those areas. So thank you, Representative Green.
Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, and not to take up any more time, but Representative Johnson, I do agree with you. The department does agree it's important to have public comment and have a dialogue, and we do that on just about everything we do. And tomorrow in Representative McNamara's committee, we're going to talk about that some more on a specific issue in the Sandstone State Forest. But to have a prescriptive process like this laid out is very concerning to us, and what that does to land acquisition. How does this get us to where we need to go by having that dialogue with those township board members, which we do on many occasions before we acquire land? Representative Van Zels is a representative of Eklund, their Eklund's district. I mean, I've been in many meetings with the township up there before we purchase things and try to work with them and try to figure out, okay, hey, if we buy this, maybe we transfer this over to the county, or we can sell this, and working with our long-range plans with the township. So we're not opposing that kind of communication. It's just the process and the onerousness of this bill is our major concern.
Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One concern I have is that because this needs to happen before a purchase agreement is executed, this lays out a process that could extend 60 days, at a minimum about 45 days, because it requires a 30-day notice before the hearing, a 10-day comment period after the hearing, and then, of course, there's going to have to be some time to process those. So maybe it wouldn't take the full up to 30 days, but it might take at least 5 days, take at least a work week to go through any comments that have been received. So 45 days, and I'm concerned that might interfere with the process of entering into a purchase agreement. If parts of this could be streamlined, if there could be some provision for a purchase agreement that's conditional upon holding these hearings, you know, things like that would make it less of a burden for the DNR to carry out the intent of the bill, I think would be useful going forward if people could, you know, try to work on that. Thank you.
Yeah. Further discussion? Representative Green.
I can wait till closing. Yeah, if you want to wait.
Sure, we're closing right now.
Okay. All I would tell you is that, yeah, I know this might be a little burdensome, but we have to remember that we sit here as legislators and the DNR as an agency, and we're not here to be served by the people. We're here to serve the people. And this is an open process. It might be a little erroneous, but if it were needed, I wouldn't have brought it. And this is what the people. There's a lot of uneasiness out there, a lot, and it's growing. And I think that if we continue to withhold the public comment and at least give the perception that we're trying to go around what the people's will is, it's not going to be good for us.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Anzel.
I believe you are misstating that the public is not allowed to comment. It feels to me that what you are saying is the public participates in comments, but if a certain group of the public or a segment of the public doesn't get its way, then we need another public hearing process managed by the DNR. And democracy, works best for the people who participate, and not everybody can get their way all the time. And adding another layer of public hearing, to me, probably is going to result in the same outcome. Another group of disgruntled citizens who don't feel like they've been heard and have gotten their way. County boards are do public comment very well. My two county boards would be upset if I didn't put on the record in Cass and Itasca County, believe me, they allow public participation and public comment on all kinds of matters at every single meeting. And Eklund just left the county board up in Cooch, and I've been there, lots of public comment there. So I agree with the DNR on this one, that this is redundant, and we should let the process work. The county boards know how to conduct public hearings.
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Green, I will renew my motion that House File 2603 be re-referred to the Committee on Environment Policy and Finance. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. The bill is on its way to the Environment Finance Committee. Representative Green will move, the chair will move House File 2590 to bring the bill before the committee, and you have an amendment, let's see, the A16-0938 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move that amendment, signify by saying aye if you approve.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Green, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill will set up, there are a few counties in Minnesota right now that already have developed a no-net gain resolution where they just feel they can't lose any more property within their county. Their property tax base is very low as it is. I know in my own district and very close to my district, we have three counties that are 25% publicly owned, 37% publicly owned, and one, Beltrami County, I believe is in the 80s. And so their tax base is dwindling, and they are there's just no place for people who want to come and settle. The land mass is shrinking because of the public ownership of the land. And what this bill does is it will have the DNR set up a database for any county that wishes to file a no-net gain policy. And within that county, if the DNR chooses to purchase land, it would have to be at county approval. I know they will tell you they get county approval, but
then there shouldn't be a problem with this if that's the case. And it also would allow the county, if they so desired, that they could require that the DNR sell the equivalent amount of land of equal value to, so that there is no net loss within that county.
Thank you. Questions, members? Commissioner Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, actually, there is no need for this bill. The counties can already do all of these things. The county boards can do all of these things. They can require as a conditional approval that an equal amount of state-owned land be sold, be offered for sale. They can also require that the new language on 1.18 to 1.22. They can require all of these things at those county board meetings. In fact, we have done this with Wadena County just recently. We worked with Wadena County, who is a no-net gain county, on a land acquisition package, and the county board approved it with these conditions in place. So, Mr. Chairman, by passing this bill, you're just making the statute books a little thicker. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Green.
The one issue that has come up is that the DNR will offer property for sale, but in many cases it's priced very high, and it doesn't always sell. And what this will do is it will say, as part of the purchase agreement, then we will require you to sell that property, so the deal will not be final until that property is sold. And if the bill is redundant, then it's redundant, but it does clarify the issue. And I can tell you that there's a chunk of land right now in one of my counties that is in a bill right now, moving through these committees, that will sell 2,000 acres of land. And the county board is not for it, and they will tell you that in the past they have not been for sales that have gone through against their will. And this, again, is just clarifying it. Now, I know you're going to lay this bill over, but I did want it heard, and if you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
Members, that is correct. I'm going to lay the bill over. I think that the last bill that we did that Representative Green brought, and this bill, and the one that is going to follow this one, are worth having a testimony to discuss some of these issues. I don't know if these are the right answers to these problems, but there is a problem. And I do think some of these things do need to be solved, and maybe not with these bills, but there are some problems out there that we do have to address. So we will be doing that maybe next year or the year after, I don't know, but I hope that we can get the DNR on board with solving some of these issues that we are facing. Representative Green, I think it's been kind of a theme this year, and I apologize, Representative Meyer, but Commissioner Meyer, but even when we have some of this public testimony and some of these public meetings, it seems like the DNR is not listening. And I think that's been a theme this year, and unfortunately, moving forward, that's why these bills are here. That's why we're giving these bills a hearing. But there's some problems out there, and they need to be solved.
Mr. Chairman, two things I want to address really quickly. One is that we are required by statute to only buy land at appraised value. Very rarely we can go above that, and very rarely do we do that. So we are not paying extraordinary prices. We're paying appraised value. Actually, we've had cases where we've come into the legislature and asked to sell at 20% below appraised value to try to get some pieces of land on the market. So we're not inflating the price out there, right? If we're paying appraised value and somebody wants to pay less than appraised value, that may be a concern that people have, but we're paying what the land is worth. And to your second comment there, Mr. Chairman, we are very concerned about the tone and the concerns that the public have about our public meetings and our open houses with them. I've had conversations with the commissioner and our senior management team about that. We are looking at how we take public comment and how we engage with the public, and are going to make some meaningful changes to that in the future. So with that, I just wanted to bring that to your attention.
Very good. I like to hear that. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Should this become the thing you would pursue, just a technical note, the lines 1.4 through 1.7 describe how a county board may adopt this policy, and then 1.8 and so on, the commissioner has to compile the list, but I don't see anything in this language for how they might rescind a policy in the future if they had adopted it. I don't know if that's something that would already be covered elsewhere, but just something to consider if you go forward.
Representative Green, any comment to that?
Well, I don't know why you would need it rescinded. They would have the option to do this or the option to not do it. It opens up a area for them to, if they want to require the land to be sold to match what was taken.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Russell.
Well, you know, we've just been hearing that they already have the ability to do some of those things. So it just seems like, for completeness, if you say somebody can adopt something, they're also, it's this kind of standard. You do this with contracts, too. You always make sure that you have a way to do it and to undo it as needed. So it just seems like it kind of presumes that it would go in perpetuity if it's done this way. And you would also be putting a burden, if they couldn't rescind it, if we somehow came up with a process whereby they could adopt it and never rescind it, you would be forcing them to be going through that process of making that decision every single time something came up in perpetuity. So it's just for completeness.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Kuchiching is just to the east of the tip that sticks out into Canada, and it's the second largest county in the state.
Cooch.
Anyway.
Do you have Cooch potatoes up there?
No, we don't, Mr. Representative. Just coming from the county board, I'm concerned about the tone of this language, and I believe Kuching has adopted this no net gain policy, Representative Green. But I heard over and over again how the state is continually tying the hands and adding restraints to what local governments can do. So I have some concerns about the tone of this and other bills. So I just thought I'd add that comment. Thank you.
With that, the chair will lay over House File 2590 for possible consideration at another time. The chair will move House File 2591 to bring the bill before the committee. And I believe there's an amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like, Representative Green, and we'll speak to the bill after the amendment is adopted. It's the A16-0939. All in favor of that amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. The bill's in the shape that you like.
Representative Green. Mr. Chair. This bill is also a pretty simple bill. It would require that all sales be approved by the legislature and by the county board. And I know you're late, this one over, and I don't want to belabor it. We're almost out of time. But just to clarify, the reason for these amendments, and where I single out the DNR and the Bowser, wasn't just to pick on them, but because with the other language, I would have had to hit every committee. And so this narrowed it down. But I'll gladly take questions on this, but if you're laying it over, I don't want to keep you here any longer than I have to.
Questions, members? Commissioner Meyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, and I will keep my comments on this one brief as well. People need to understand it's not Commissioner Landwehr who sits in his office and says, we've got to go buy more land. It's the citizens of the state of Minnesota. It's your constituents. It's the people who want the state to protect land that's out there that's driving this activity, right? So it's not the DNR making this up. It's the citizens of the state, the sportsmen and women, the outdoor enthusiasts, the naturists, the naturalists, whoever wants this land protected, that's driving these activities. So it's not the DNR. And the other part of the coin is it's your constituents who want to sell this land to the state. So as we talk about all these things, we need to be very careful that we're allowing people to sell their land who they want to, and that we're doing it in the right way. But, you know, this whole discussion, I think, is somewhat concerning that it's the DNR who's looking to buy all this land just on our own. It's individuals who want to sell land to the state. It's your voters who want to sell their land to the state. And it's your voters, our customers, who want us to buy land as well. So I just want to put that on the record, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Green?
I have to clarify a little bit there. First of all, it's not a question of who can you sell your land to. It's how much should the state be buying. When Minnesota is already over 25% now publicly owned, and the only people that own more land than the state of Minnesota, and it bobs back and forth between third and fourth, is the United States government and the state of Alaska. And so this is our tax base. And I can tell you that maybe the people in the metro area, maybe even in your area, Representative Anzels, want more public land. But the people in my area do not. And it's our land that's being bought. I am here and I was elected to represent the people of my district, and that's what I intend to do. And so this fight will go on.
You're doing a good job, Representative Green. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Green, again, I want to thank you for bringing this issue forward. We have a number of areas in the state where the counties are 30, 40, 50, and as you mentioned, up to 80% either state or federally owned. When you take a large county and have 80% of it owned by either the state or the federal government, it doesn't leave much land left for the people that live there to maintain their property and the roads in that county, because even though the state owns land around it, is the state paying the property taxes for the schools? Is the state paying the property taxes to maintain the roads? But my guess is they're not. We also have the issue many years ago, if you remember, when the agricultural industry had some problems. We had a lot of farmers going out of business, and they're getting foreclosed on because of loans that were given. Before that land could be sold to anybody else, once it was started the process, DNR was grabbing every piece of agricultural land and making it state property, and turning around selling the house and a couple acres that it was attached to it. I believe last year I asked the DNR for some information on how many acres of land the DNR has purchased over the last 10 years and the gain in the amount of acreage. The only thing I received was the parcel numbers. I still don't know the total number of acreage that was purchased. So I just want to thank you for bringing this forward.
Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in the free market of real estate and real estate transactions, one of the covenants that is most important is time is of the essence. And I can't imagine subjecting constituents whose maybe competitive market or able and willing arm's length buyer is asked to sit on their property and can't close until the legislature reconvenes and it has to make its way through the legislative process, that transaction, just like any of the other 2,600 bills that come before us. I think that's an onerous and cumbersome thing to put upon any private property owner. If it's their property, they have a right to do with what they want. We in the legislature establish parameters in which the DNR can purchase property. I think that's in statute already. But to ask somebody to sit there and have to sit on that land, if that's their buyer, if that's the arm's length, highest and best use, whatever their circumstances are, I wouldn't support this.
Any further discussion? With that, the chair will lay over House File 2591 for possible consideration at another time. Members, just an announcement. This committee will be meeting jointly with the Jobs Committee at 6 p.m. in this very room tonight at 6 p.m. We will be televised, so please be on time. And it's just an informational hearing about possible restructuring of the IRRRB. With that, members, meeting is adjourned. Okay, we'll bring the Joint Committee of the Mining and Outdoor Recreation Committee and the Job Growth and Energy Affordability Policy Finance Committee to order. Folks, this is a joint committee, and we're going to hear a presentation by the Office of the Legislative Auditor on the IRRRB and their findings. Auditor Noble, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the Joint Committee. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the Legislative Auditor, and with me at the table is Elizabeth Stawicki, the Director of our Legal Research Unit, and Jody Hauer, who was the manager of our evaluation of the IRRRB.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you and members for being here. I know you've had a long day, and your attendance here is much appreciated. We actually think this is an important report, because the Iron Range is important to the state of Minnesota, and the IRRRB is important to the Iron Range, and frankly, they're both important to all of us. And the Iron Range, as we know, is hurting, and more than ever, it needs help. And the IRRRB was established in 1941 specifically to strengthen and diversify the economy of the Iron Range. In our evaluation, we found that the IRRRB needs to have some tuning up and some improvements in its operations, and that will take the work of the administration. We also found that the governance structure, the IRRB, is vulnerable to a constitutional challenge, and that will take you to fix. So, Mr. Chairman, without any other words from me, except I'll be here certainly to answer questions, I'd like to turn to Ms. Hauer to make a presentation of the evaluation component, and then we will turn to Ms. DeWicke to talk about the constitutional issue.
Thank you. Ms. Hauer, please state your name and who you represent, just for the record, and then proceed.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the Joint Committees. My name is Jody Hauer. I'm with the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And I will be going through a brief summary of the contents of this evaluation report tonight. Before I do that, I would like to acknowledge my team members who worked with me on this evaluation report. Laura Lawson is sitting behind me. Laura Schwartz, another one of our teammates, is not here tonight, but also was a big contribution to the report. I'm going to start by providing an overview of the key findings that we have from this evaluation study and then get into some detail on each one of them. We found issues in three major areas, and the first of the areas is the loans and the grants that the IRRB agency awards. The first finding is that among the groups of the loans and the grants that we looked at as a part of our evaluation, we found that many of those contained limited evidence that they had actually met the objectives that had been set out for them. A second finding is that among the practices that the IRRB follows for measuring job creation, many of them are inadequate. Another finding is that it was unclear whether IRRB provided loans to some applicants that may not have expressly needed agency funding to proceed. Another finding is that among the grant programs, the IRRB has 13 different grant programs, but some of them do not comply with the agency's own policies for managing grants. And finally, in this section, we found that the IRRB has not systematically evaluated how well its grants and loans have performed. They don't know what the impact is of those grants and loans on the region that they serve. Now, the second area of findings has to do with the Giants Ridge Recreation Area. Many of you may know this is a golf and ski resort located in Bowabic. It's owned by the IRRB and partially operated by the IRRB. We found that the resort has a large and growing operating loss. We also found that the IRRB has not established sufficient targets to understand how well Giants Ridge may be progressing toward the goals that have been set out for it. And then the third area, which Auditor Nobles has already alluded to, has to do with the structure of the board itself. And here we found that the structure of the board, which is set in statute, is vulnerable to a constitutional challenge. We will get into some more detail in each one of these findings, but I want to provide some context first for those of you who may need that just to understand what the findings are. First, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board is the name of the state agency that has been around since 1941, and it has been involved in economic development, in workforce development, community development since that time. Last year, the agency had a budget of $41 million. And unlike other state agencies that rely on the state's general fund to provide revenues, with the IRRB, the primary funding source is mineral taxation, mining taxes that the mining companies themselves pay on every ton of taconite that they produce. The agency is run by a commissioner, and Commissioner Phillips is here, and we'll be talking with you later. The commissioner is appointed by the governor. Now, that's the agency, but for the board itself, the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Board also refers to a governing board that was established back in 1943. It oversees the agency. The structure of the board is set in statute as well, and it has varied somewhat over the years, but currently it has 9 members, and all of those members are legislators. The board has substantial authority over the agency in that the statutes currently require the board to approve or disapprove all expenditures or all proposals that the commissioner might make. Now, As we said, the IRRB is a state agency, but its services are focused entirely on the Iron Range in northeastern Minnesota. The service area, too, is defined in statute, and it's defined by the boundaries of 15 school districts, which are depicted here on this slide in green. It cuts across all or parts of seven counties. We found that economic conditions in northeast Minnesota are less robust than practically everywhere else in the state. So, for instance, looking at unemployment, we looked at annual unemployment rates, so we found that northeast Minnesota has had a higher annual unemployment rate for all but two out of the last 15 years. If you look at this particular slide, the red line on top represents the northeast Minnesota region. The middle line here, the one in green, depicts northwest Minnesota. And if you look where they might cross, you see that only in 2000 and 2006 did northwest Minnesota have a higher annual unemployment rate than northeast Minnesota. The white dashed line at the bottom of this slide represents statewide unemployment. You can see that from 2000 forward, it was consistently below the annual unemployment rate in northeast Minnesota, and in fact, over this period since 2000, it was between 1 and 2.5 percentage points below unemployment, annual unemployment in northeast Minnesota. We also found that employment growth was weaker in the IRRB service area than elsewhere in the state. One way of representing this is thinking about the major industry sectors. There are 20 industry sectors overall. In the IRRB service area, 14 of those 20 industry sectors had declines in employment since 2000. And this compares to outstate Minnesota as a whole, where 6 of those 20 industry sectors had declines in employment since 2000. Now, in most of these industry sectors, employment growth or decline was worse in the IRRB service area than it was elsewhere. And this table will show just a couple of examples. We'll list down the left-hand side of this table the top five industry sectors in terms of employment in the IRRB service area since 2014. And if you look across this top row, we're looking at the healthcare and social assistance sector. That represented over 11,000 employees in the IRRB service area. You can see there was growth there. There was growth across the entire state in this particular sector, but in the IRRB service area, the growth was less than it was elsewhere. If you look at the fourth line, that's the mining and quarrying industry sector. That represented 4,600 jobs on the Iron Range back in 2014. And if you look across this row, there was a decline in employment in this sector across the state, but that 18% decline in the IRRB service area was the greatest of the declines anywhere else. I'm not going to go through the rest of these, but if you were to look at this table in detail, you'll see that for all of these industry sectors, which represent the top employment sectors for the IRRB service area, that employment growth or decline since 2000 was worse in the IRRB service area than it was elsewhere in the state. The last bit of background information I'll provide has to do with just a summary of the kind of work that the IRRB agency does. Much of the economic development work is done through awarding loans and grants. Regarding the loans, IRRB loans typically go to businesses that are either located in the northeastern part of the state or want to locate or expand there. For the last five-year period, IRRB awarded a median of 9 loans each year, and that represented a median $12 million total annually. On the other side of the picture are the grants. For the grants, they typically go to municipalities and usually for public infrastructure projects. Over that same five-year period, IRRB awarded a median 147 grants, and that was a median $13.6 million total annually. As I said, most of the grants are for public works infrastructure projects, but the agency also has grants for culture and tourism, for workforce development, and a variety of other purposes. If you would like to look at those and you have the full report in front of you, they're listed on page 5 in a table that also gives a brief description of each one of those 13 grant programs. Now I'm going to get back to our findings. We found when we were looking at loans, a sample of loans, that many of them did not meet the job creation objectives that had been set out for them. The objectives are specified in the application materials that a company would submit when it's interested in getting a loan from the IRRB, and it also they're also in the loan contracts that are written between the agency and the company receiving the loan. Now, for this evaluation, we looked in depth at a small number, at 16 loans and 23 grants. And I do want to point out that these numbers aren't large enough to statistically represent all of the agency's loans or all of the agency's grants, but they did provide us valuable information about how the agency operates. So, looking at the loans, in the group we looked at, 15 of the loans had objectives that included job creation. And of those 15, 7 of the companies had not met those job creation goals as of last fall when we did our review. I would like to give you one example. There was one company that received a $200,000 loan to assist that company with expanding its building that was already up in the area and also to purchase some manufacturing equipment. Unfortunately, within less than 3 years of receiving the loan, this particular company fell on hard times. It had to declare bankruptcy, and it was unable to create any of the 5 jobs that had been set out for it in its application materials. Then again, back to the 15 loan files we reviewed, 6 of those, it was just too early to tell whether or not they're going to meet their job creation objectives. So of those we looked at, 2 of the 15 had loans that showed job growth aligned with the growth that had been set out for those companies at the time that they applied and then were awarded the loans. Now, turning to the grants, as I said, we looked at 23 files, but of those 23, there were 18 that had been completed at the time we did a review last fall. Of those 18 grants, 8 of them had no clear information on whether or not objectives that had been set out for them were actually met. Again, I'll give you an example. One city, a small city, had received a $20,000 grant, which it coupled with other funding sources. In its application materials, it said that it would use this money to do a road reconstruction project. That project would generate between 10 and 15 construction jobs, and it would lead to development in the city. We reviewed the loan package. This is a grant, not a loan. We reviewed the grant package, and we talked to staff about this particular grant, as we did with the others. And there was no evidence that the road reconstruction project had been done, or that any jobs had been created, or that any development had occurred in the city that received the grant. At the same time, 10 of the 18 that we reviewed did have at least partial information about meeting some of the objectives that had been set out for those particular grant projects. I want to move on now to what...
One moment, Representative Anzels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if it's appropriate or not, but my question may be very relevant, and I don't want it to get lost in the presentation. I find it unusual, if not stunning, that your analysis of loans and grants covers the years 11 through 15. My first question is, can you tell us why you did not go further as far back as 2002?
Mr. Chair and Representative Anzels, in fact, the grants were ones that we selected randomly from that last 5-year period, but for the loans, we did go back farther in time. So we actually have, I can point to you the page in the full report that lists the loans and the years that they were awarded. So page 23 of the full report lists the loans, and you can see that some go back as far as 2008. There was we also added to the list of loans that we had selected randomly 3 loans in particular that had been highlighted by the press, had highlighted by legislators in the past, and so those actually go back to 2004 and 2006. That included the Excelsior Energy loan, Meyer and Associates, and the Silicon Energy. So we did go back somewhat farther than we did for the grants, which did come from the most recent 5-year period.
Well, Mr. Chairman, just a brief follow-up.
Sure.
Thank you for acknowledging the Excelsior Energy issue. That certainly was highlighted in the press. Can you tell us why an arrangement, a loan, between the IRRRB and Excelsior Energy, which was far and away larger than any other loan in agency history, $9.5 million, $1.02 million, and I believe $8.5 million in seven. One would think that the history of that, the failure of that, the inability of any jobs to be created other than jobs for lawyers, lobbyists, and people who go to meetings, your audit ignored all of that. Your audit ignores the extension of the loan from, I believe, 12 to 2017, and then your audit ignores a resolution brought to the board to simply absolve Excelsior Energy of any repayment of the $9.5 million without having ever created a job. I hope you haven't been muzzled here, because this issue stands out to the people of the Taconite Assistance Area more than any $200,000 grant to a company to build a Martin building.
Mr. Chairman,
could you respond to that?
Ms. Nobles? To Representative Antel, because I think you make an excellent point that I appreciate you making, and I guess you ask why we didn't highlight it more. I think for two reasons that I can think of, and certainly ask Ms. Howard to comment if she would like. Number one, I think it has been highlighted a great deal. There has been a good deal of media coverage. And in fact, we have probably received more allegations and complaints about the Excelsior development project than any other. And we, in fact, conducted an investigation about how the money had been used. In addition to the IRRRB money, you undoubtedly are aware that there was a $10 million grant or loan of money from the Renewable Energy Fund, which we questioned in a report we did on the Renewable Energy Fund, because in fact the Excelsior project was not, we thought, consistent with the purposes of that fund. It was a coal gasification project, not a renewable energy renewable energy from renewable sources, which coal is not renewable. So we've heavily investigated, criticized, as I think others have. But I think Representative Antel's as well. No, we haven't been muzzled. As we do in all of our work, it's our work. Nobody influences us, legislators, lobbyists, lawyers. We do the work ourselves. They are our findings, and our goal is always to be objective and accurate. I think the other reason I would add is that we didn't want to just pick out one project, which, as you, I think, so accurately state, has been one of the most dramatic, and I think I'll use your word, failures in that part of the state. I think many people had good intentions. Many people thought that jobs would be created. And that we would, in fact, create a source of energy, not from a renewable source, but we would create energy up on the Iron Range. It did not work for a lot of reasons. So that's what I would add. I think we wanted to be fair and look at a broad sample of projects and not highlight one that really, I think, illustrates a very unfortunate situation for people in the state as well as on the Iron Range.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair.
Quite all right. Ms. Hall, would you like to add?
Mr. Chair, Representative Ansels, the only thing I would say is that you'll see, if you were to read the contents of this report, that we don't highlight a single loan really in any of our findings. We were looking at them as a group to see if we could get some kind of overall sense of how well things were going. But that doesn't mean we didn't intensively research each one of those loans. We did. So we were very well aware of the situation you described, and went through hundreds and hundreds of pages of information about that loan in particular, but the other loans as well.
Thank you for your explanation.
Anything further, Representative Enzel? Okay. Members, we're going to try to get through the presentation, and hopefully we can do questions after the presentation. There's a committee that's going to, Representative Garofalo's committee is going to meet right after this one, and he's got a number of bills to get through. So we're going to try to wrap things up 7:15 at the latest. So hopefully we can get through the presentation and take everyone's questions. Please proceed, Ms. Howard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm going to move on to our next area of findings, which had to do with how the agency measures job creation. And we found that, with one important exception, that IRRB's practices for measuring job creation are inadequate. Now, this one exception is the forgivable loans that IRRB has awarded over time. With the forgivable loans, if the borrowing company creates so many jobs by a certain date, then the IRRB will forgive a portion or perhaps all of that loan, or that it might impose a lower interest rate on the balance of the loan. So for these loans, we found that IRRB staff monitor job creation very closely, as they should. But beyond that exception, we found that IRRB does not have reliable records of jobs created or retained by the projects that it funded. And so for these other loans, the non-forgivable loans, IRRB relies on what it calls its job audit. This is an email that the staff send to the borrowing companies every year, and it requests that the companies report on their level of employment as of July 1st of that year. And we found that this audit had several problems. The first is that companies are not required to report, and we found that many did not. In fact, for the 2014 year, we found that 20% of them just simply did not report back to the agency, and so the agency doesn't have information about the jobs that were created, if there had been any, for those 20% of the companies. The second problem was that the data are all self-reported, and staff do not take additional steps to verify those self-reported data. The third problem is that the audit does not reveal when the jobs were created, and so it's very difficult to know if a company had created that job for the full year, for 10 months of the year, for 1 month of the year. We just don't know, and the data won't tell us. A related issue is the agency's loan database. Now, this is a database that the agency relies on to have a count of the loans in its portfolio. But we found that the database now in use is both unreliable and insufficient. First, the database does not provide an accurate count of the loans that are in the portfolio. It's an archaic system. It was created back in 1987. It has duplicate records for single loan. It contains some codes that the staff no longer use, and many don't even understand what they refer to anymore. Moreover, from our vantage point, it seemed that the database was insufficient because it didn't include some very important data, things like what number of jobs were created, so that the agency could understand what its impact is on its service area. Now, as part of our evaluation, we reviewed quite a bit of literature from economists and other economic development specialists. The literature emphasized that economic development agencies need to conduct an evaluation of their programs so that they can understand whether those programs made a difference in their local economies. But we found that the IRRB has not systematically evaluated its programs or analyzed what its impact is on the northeastern region of the state. In the reports that the IRRB has issued, it tends to focus on the forecasted job growth, but less so on the numbers of jobs that actually materialized. Now, to give the agency credit, last year, the IRRB started a new method of trying to evaluate what its grant programs were accomplishing, and we think those are obviously steps in the right direction. They completed one program's evaluation and were in the process of two others in 2015. The agency has also reported that it intends to complete those evaluations for the remaining of the 13 grant programs and also for the loan program. Again, in the literature that we looked at, the economists emphasized the importance of knowing whether a project that gets public money would have occurred without that public assistance. And that's the so-called but-for test that I'm sure most of you are familiar with. This is important in understanding whether the public financing achieved the job growth or achieved the private investment beyond what would have occurred without the public money being used. Well, IRRB has several loan criteria that staff use when it's when staff are going through the applications for the loans. Things like what are the numbers of jobs that can be anticipated from this project? What's the creditworthiness of the applicant? What's the applicant's ability to leverage other funding, and so on. But the agency does not determine the degree to which the loan applicant's proposals need public assistance in order to proceed. Now, we recognize that there are some companies, those that can choose between locating in northeast Minnesota or locating pretty much anywhere else in the state or even outside of the state. And we think that in those cases, the IRRB financial incentives may be a good use of the public dollars for northeast Minnesota. But for others, for those companies that are in the region or already plan to build or expand there, and they need some assistance for their project, the agency does not determine how many of those projects depend on that IRRB financing in order to go forward. I'm going to move now to grants. The agency does have a grants manual that lays out the policies on how staff are going to manage the grants that are awarded. The manual is patterned after recommendations of the state's Office of Grants Management. The agency has had that manual in place since 2010, and in fact, it was just updated last year in 2015. The manual covers numerous policies, everything from what staff should evaluate as grant applications come in, to how they're going to monitor the grantees that receive the money, and all the way through to the end of the project and how those projects are supposed to be tied up when they're completed. But in the sample of grants that we reviewed, we found a number of the individual grants that had not been monitored correctly. Monitoring has a number of different components in the policy manual, the agency's policy manual, but I'll talk just about one. One of the policies requires that all of the grant recipients will supply a final report of what was accomplished with the grant when that project has been concluded. In the set of grants that we looked through, a quarter of the grant files did not have those final reports. And in each case, we did verify with staff that, yes, there really had not been a final report for those particular grants. So beyond those individual grants, there was a small number of grant programs that didn't follow agency policies in every respect. One example was that the policy requires IRRB to pay out the grants on a reimbursement basis instead of at the front end of a project. That allows the staff to determine that the expenses that are submitted are actually eligible to be reimbursed. However, through 2015, the Workforce Development Grant Program and the Higher Education Account did not provide funding based on reimbursements and instead were provided at the front end of the project before the project got underway. So based on these findings that I've just summarized, we have a number of recommendations to the agency. I'll summarize those here. First, we recommend that IRRB redesign its loan program so that companies will meet their job creation objectives. This means having IRRB specify in the contracts for the direct loans that specify what the number of jobs will be if those loans are granted. It also could mean structuring the loans in a way that the agency advances the loan to the company only after the job creation goals have been met. A second recommendation is that the agency improve how it measures job creation. So this includes requiring the borrowing companies to provide the data that staff need in sufficient detail that staff can tell, was there job growth, was there job decline, and how did that change over time? Our third recommendation is that IRRB maintain an accurate database of its loans. This also includes having the necessary information that the agency needs if it's going to understand what its impact is on the region. Our fourth recommendation is that the agency explicitly analyze to what extent the loan applicants can complete their projects without IRRB funding. Now, this so-called but-for test wouldn't necessarily apply when IRRB determines that an applicant can readily locate elsewhere. But we think it is important for them to proactively make that assessment when they're reviewing the applications as they come in. Fifth, we recommend that IRRB consistently determine how well its grants meet their objectives. This tied to this is also ensuring that all of the grant programs comply with the agency's own policies that apply to those grants. And then our final recommendation in this area is that the IRRRB regularly evaluate its loan program and its grant programs so that it can analyze what the collective impact is of those programs on Northeast Minnesota. Mr. Chair, with that, I'm going to move to the second area of findings, and that's the Giants Ridge Recreation Area. A little bit of background first. It was purchased in the early 1980s by IRRRB. IRRRB staff administer the Giants Ridge Recreation Area, and they run the outside ski operations there. IRRRB contracts with other vendors, though, to do their other major operations, which is the golf and the food and beverage operation. Back when it was purchased, the Giants Ridge Recreation Area had four goals assigned to it by the agency, and those same goals apply today. One of them is to create economic development. The other three goals, I won't go through each one here, but they're listed on the slide. They're also in the full report if you care to look on page 52 of the full report. I want to report next what we found when we looked at the financial data for Giants Ridge. We looked between 2006 and 2014, and we saw that the operating loss for Giants Ridge grew by more than 500% over that nine-year period. And that's in dollars that are adjusted for inflation. Over that period, IRRRB subsidized operations with $17.4 million to cover that operating loss. This averaged out to $1.9 million every year of that nine-year period. Now, Giants Ridge had this huge operating loss because the expenses grew faster than the revenues did in each of the key areas, the golf, the ski, and food and beverage. We also looked at how IRRRB measures Giants Ridge's performance. The agency will set every year budgetary measures to judge the performance of Giants Ridge. So that is, they'll set revenue targets. How much do they expect in revenue from the ski admissions, from the golf course greens fees, from retail sales, et cetera? And it will also set expenditure targets so that they will have an idea of how much will be spent on salaries, on management fees, and the like. Then, at the end of the year, the agency will compare the actual revenues, actual expenditures, with those budgeted targets. And this is something that is necessary, but it's an insufficient measure. We think that IRRRB should also judge whether Giants Ridge is making adequate progress toward the four stated goals that are in place. Now, IRRRB does have some measures of performance for Giants Ridge, but we found that it hasn't set sufficient targets for the agency to understand how well Giants Ridge is meeting those goals. It does look at things like, what is the summer attendance? What is the winter attendance? What is the level of customer satisfaction from both those summer and winter visitors? It's looked at things like what kind of job creation has occurred because of Giants Ridge, and what are some of the economic ripple effects due to Giants Ridge. But in each case, it hasn't set the targets for these measures. So we don't know, like, how high does the level of visitor satisfaction have to be, or how many jobs have to be generated by Giants Ridge in order to understand how well Giants Ridge is progressing toward meeting its goals. We have one recommendation on Giants Ridge, although it's twofold. The first, that IRRRB should set criteria so that it can understand how well Giants Ridge is meeting the four stated goals. But it should also analyze Giants Ridge in light of the growing operating losses and then determine whether Giants Ridge remains consistent with the agency's mission. With that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn the microphone over to Elizabeth Stowicki, who will talk about the third and final piece of our findings.
Very good. Ms. Stowicki?
For the record, my name is Elizabeth Stowicki, and I'm the Director of Legal Research for OLA. Mr. Chair and members of the Joint Committee, we conclude that a state law that grants a board of legislators significant power over an executive agency spending decisions is vulnerable to a challenge under two provisions of the Minnesota Constitution, separation of powers and the ban against legislators holding another public office. That's due largely because of a change in the law. Before 1995, legislators on the IRRRB were merely advisory. They had no final authority over the commissioner's decisions. But in 1995,
the legislature enacted a law that granted the board power to approve the commissioner's spending and projects. We believe that power structure makes the IRRRB statute vulnerable to a separation of powers challenge, as well as dual office holding, which we'll talk about later. A person could argue that the legislators serving on the board are usurping executive branch powers. As we all know, separation of powers is a bedrock principle of American government, and the framers included that principle in Minnesota's Constitution in 1857. In fact, Minnesota is considered a strong separation of power state, and here's why. First, like many other state constitutions, Minnesota's constitution divides the branches into three distinct departments, legislative, executive, and judicial. But then, our constitution goes further and says no person or persons belonging to or constituting one of these departments shall exercise any of the powers properly belonging to either of the others except in the instances expressly provided in this constitution. We also examined the transcripts of the 1857 Constitutional Convention and found the delegates hotly debated and intentionally added this second sentence in the separation of powers clause. For example, convention delegates such as former territorial governor Willis Gorman were adamant about a strong division between members of one branch exercising another branch's powers. If a man belongs to the legislative department, for instance, this article is intended to prevent him from exercising any of the duties in the executive department. Nonetheless, we could find no case where Minnesota's Supreme Court has weighed in on whether a law that designates legislators as voting members of an executive agency board violates the Constitution. Still, based on the wording of Minnesota's Constitution and the convention debates, we believe the IRRRB statute is vulnerable to a challenge on separation of powers grounds. We say vulnerable because we don't know how a court would decide such a question, particularly since a ruling would depend on specifics. How an attorney framed the case legally, the alleged harm done, and other factors the court might weigh. We also believe that a person could challenge the IRRRB statute in connection with the state constitution's ban on legislators holding another public office. This is sometimes called the dual office holding prohibition. Minnesota's constitution says, no senator or representative shall hold any other office under the authority of the United States or the state of Minnesota except that of postmaster or notary public. If elected or appointed to another office, a legislator may resign from the legislature by tendering his resignation to the governor. As we did for the separation of powers clause, we also went back and read the transcripts from the Constitutional Convention to get a sense of what the framers were trying to accomplish with this clause. Among many who supported this principle was Territorial Supreme Court Justice Bradley Meeker, who said, "It is our business in framing the fundamental law of the land to see that one man does not hold two, four, or six offices in different departments of the government." Unfortunately, neither the state constitution nor state law defines what constitutes another office under the dual office holding ban. But in 1974, the Minnesota Supreme Court provided us with what's known as the McCutcheon test. The question in that case was whether William McCutcheon and two others, who were both legislators and police officers, were holding two public offices. The court said no, that a police officer is not a public office. In the process, the court devised a test of what does constitute a public office as far as the state constitution is concerned. And that's whether that person has independent authority under law, either alone or with others of equal authority, to determine public policy or make a final decision not subject to the supervisory approval or disapproval of another. So in the IRRB's case, the question then is whether the board's decisions are final or subject to the supervisory approval of another. That's tricky because, as we highlight on page 13 of our report, the governor approves some of the board's decisions, but not all. In some cases, the Board of Legislators has the final word. At the very least, a court could find that in those situations where the board makes the final decision, the statute violates the ban, on legislators holding another public office. We also add that while it is not binding as a court decision, the Attorney General in 1949 issued an opinion that provides us with insight that is relevant to today's IRRRB law. In 1949, the IRRRB commissioner asked Attorney General J.A. Burnquist whether he had the power to move ahead with projects and spending if the board disapproved. Burnquist wrote back to say that if a board of legislators had the power to disapprove the commissioner's project, they would be violating the Constitution by holding another public office. The Attorney General issued his opinion in 1949, but we think it's relevant today because he was essentially saying that if legislators had the kind of power they in fact have today, serving on the board would constitute another public office. In conclusion, again, we are not a court, and we don't know how a court would rule, but we do feel comfortable saying that the IRRRB statute is vulnerable to a challenge under the dual office prohibition, as well as separation of powers. Our appendix also includes options to reduce or eliminate that vulnerability. And with that, Mr. Chair, we are available for questions.
Okay. Mr. Nobles, because of your report, where are we at, in your opinion? Is it going to be more than just returning the board to pre-1995 times and straightening out the constitutional question that way? It seems to me that there's more to your report than that. It's going to take more extensive changes within the IRRRB to oversee some of these things that have been happening and where the money's going and what's being done with it and some oversight with actually what's taking place there.
Mr. Chairman, I believe this is a serious report with a lot of criticisms. And, you know, I think as with any organization where we deliver this kind of report, there are a lot of options and a lot of areas that need to be changed. I think one of the things that I would say in response to your question is I think the IRRRB, with the governance structure that it has been somewhat isolated, frankly, from the normal process of legislative oversight. I mean, I would ask some of you, how many times have you had the IRRRB before you for this kind of hearing? And I think it is partly because you have, in law, as Ms. DeWicke just said, delegated that responsibility to Iron Range legislators. And I think you will certainly hear from them, we certainly heard from them, that they feel that's appropriate because they're accountable to the people of the Iron Range. But in our view, the Iron Range is part of the state of Minnesota, just like every other part is. And what happens on the Iron Range affects the entire state. And I think should be subject to the same kind of oversight that any other state agency is. And frankly, should also be subject to oversight by the governor's office. But again, I think the fact that there is this board, which is supposed to do that job on behalf of the governor, on behalf of you, the rest of the legislature, may have had some influence on inhibiting you from doing so and isolating the IRRRB from the kind of oversight that we've provided to you. And I guess I would say, finally, I think it was a good thing that many of you asked us, the Office of Legislative Auditor, to go and do the kind of evaluation that we did and delivered to you. That is a mechanism of legislative oversight, but it's a one-time evaluation. What is needed is ongoing, rigorous oversight of the IRRRB from all of you.
Thank you. We'll have a few folks that have some questions. We got a list. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 2 points. One, the board's power in slide 19. All but three of the IRRRB's spending decisions require the sign off by the governor at the time. There are three distributions that do not require the governor's signature, and the delegation, the Iron Range delegation, is working on a bill to correct that. Secondly, and most importantly, members, the mining companies don't pay property taxes. None. Zero. They contribute zero to the city of Coleraine's public works services to the citizens. Zero. They pay $2.60 a long ton production tax. Some of it goes to buy down property taxes that all homesteads in the Taconite assistance area receive. Much of it goes to the IRRRB. I use the term long ton. You'd be surprised to know that the companies have actually been cheating the people by 200 pounds a ton. In the form and the manner in which taconite taxes are computed because of the long ton definition. Having said that, these are property taxes. It's a production tax paid by the mining companies in lieu of property taxes. The schools, the municipalities, the counties and the townships do not get property tax payments from mining companies because we learned it is impossible to judge and define the value of unmined ore. How would you know in 1943 what the ore body at the Canisteo was worth until you mined it, until you sold it? Prices fluctuate. That system didn't work. So beginning in 41, visionary people went to a production tax. It is $2.60 a long ton. It is our property taxes. People on the range aren't interested in oversight when the municipality of Minnetonka decides to build a community swimming pool. That's not our business. That's the citizens of Minnetonka's business. This is a hybrid. It is designed to restore and maintain the economic vitality of a six-county region. Economic development in rural areas dependent on natural resources cannot be done piecemeal, can only be done with a regional approach. That is the largest part of the mission of that agency. But there's another part of the mission. The people deserve services. Water, sewer, curb, gutter, municipal buildings. Just like every other community in any other part of the state. But their major taxpayer pays nothing to support those community services. That money is part of the taconite distribution in the form of projects, grants, and loans to local units of government. It would be better, in my view, and my view is a minority view, to allocate public works and public infrastructure from the mining companies two eligible local units of government on a formula basis rather than the current situation. But please understand that this is our wealth. To a large extent, because of public ownership, public land, in forestry and mining, we are property poor. This is our wealth. It's the reason for the IRRRB. It's the reason why visionary people created it. And it's the reason why I just caution us at overreacting and proposing radical solutions that the people of northeastern Minnesota will not support.
Well, we've got a list here, but I just have to respond, Representative Anzels. You are absolutely right, and I don't think anybody wants to do what you claim we're looking to do. But it is your wealth, and we want it to pay off for you. When you give out loans that do nothing but make people rich and they're off with the money and they're gone, that's not helping your area. We need to change that. There needs to be more oversight of that. We don't know what's happening to some of this money, and we want it to be better on the Iron Range, and if things are actually getting done and working in the direction towards the main goals of what we want to happen, what you want to happen, and what your constituents want to happen, something has to change. And I want to work with the delegation to put something together that's going to actually happen. Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Auditor and staff, for a thorough report. I think my colleague just touched on something very important, and just for clarification for the record, for those listening at home, in the total amount of accounts that we sit on as board members, is it correct of me to say that only three do not have or have constitutional issues?
Mr. Chairman, members, I think this is something you really need to think through, because yes, I think having the governor sign off on the board's decisions would be a step in the right direction, but I can't sit here and tell you it would be enough to completely eliminate the constitutional possibility of a challenge, and here's why. If that change simply has the governor being able to consider approving or disapproving what you approve, you are not allowing the commissioner to put forth to the governor for his approval or disapproval something you do not approve. So I think, you know, it could still be interpreted as an impediment to the governor's authority and the commissioner's authority to exercise within the executive branch the normal chain of command, so to speak. You would, in a sense, be a gatekeeper and not allow the commissioner to go forward to seek the governor's approval or disapproval of a project that you disapprove. So I think to really be advisory, you have to make a recommendation on what the commissioner is proposing to send to the governor. That truly would be advisory.
Follow up, Mr.
Representative Metzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, in my short time on the board as a member, I can't think of an instance actually where the commissioner presented a budget where there was anything more really than an advisory opinion. We don't get to sit in the rooms with the staff when they're putting these together. That's all done independently. Before a board meeting, we're given a briefing to look at it and give feedback to the commissioner. Do you think it's unconstitutional for us as board members to give feedback to a commissioner who is requesting it to make decisions and alter something that he would be proposing to the governor?
Mr. Noble? Chairman, members, what the law actually says is that you have to approve the budget. That's what the law says. So I think the law makes your input more than advisory. It means that if you don't approve the budget, you don't approve the budget, and therefore the commissioner doesn't have a budget. So that's more than advisory. That's more than input. That's the power to control his budget within an executive branch agency.
Representative Metzen.
Follow-up. I was wondering, Commissioner Phillips, would you mind coming up? And
Representative Metzen, we're going to bring Commissioner Phillips up when we're done with questions. We're going to bring them up.
So I should save this line of questioning for later then?
Yeah. We're going to bring Commissioner Phillips up as soon as we're done with a couple of more questions.
Okay. And then I did have one other follow-up.
Sure. Go ahead.
In regard to the property tax, I do think that Representative Anzels hit the nail on the head. This is something that our communities have had for many years, and when we do look at any public spending up there, like I know we talked about a grant to a city, or maybe it was a loan in the $20,000 mark for a street, I can't think of any other instance down here where if we give funding to a community for public works like that, that we would scrutinize it from a statewide level. And I agree with my colleague as well, and we've talked about this a number of times in moving towards the formula for those types of things and been discussing that for the last few years. But I think the public should also know that, between governors, I know that in my district, with the former representative who was there while I was a constituent of it, every single bonding project almost was vetoed by the governor, and that, there were political plays made with this board. And so what I'm hoping comes out of this, members, is to kind of take the political football out, let the good people at the agency do their work, and incorporate, the changes that we can down here that achieve the goals that we're looking for, and I think you'll have our support in that. We can always strive to do better, and we should never look at criticism as something where we're getting picked on in this case, and I don't look at it that way. I think that we have opportunity to grow here, and that moving forward, this will make our agency better. I'm proud of the work that Commissioner Phillips has done, coming in from Deed and with a background in business, in implementing some of the oversight that you pointed out started in 2015 under his commissionership. And as we're moving forward, the other changes suggested here will incorporate, I believe, as a body here, some of those changes this year, and hope that we can get a hearing in jobs and work that through, Mr. Chair. So, at the end of the day, I do think that it's fair to say that this was a good report. You've found some good things. In Giants Ridge in particular, what I did want to touch on, you had referred to it as purchased by the IRRRB. And when we do talk about things purchased, say, by deed or any other thing, we refer to it as purchased by the state. And so I think, just to clarify there, that it was a state purchase of a resource that all of us and all of our constituents here at the table have access to. And we do have some very good new findings from an economic impact statement or a study that was done on that, which I'll wait to ask or let the commissioner describe. But again, it's an example of something in 2008. I don't remember the economy being too hot. I remember having a really hard time finding a job as a young guy in school, and many of my friends in the same boat, and many of us here sitting at this table in other fields, as this is a part-time legislature, having those same difficulties. And so I'd like the board or the group here to consider, in that time period, we looked at 2008, 2009, 2010, I think some of what we see in those lost revenue sources is just people not having money to spend in general around the whole country. And when you have projected investments that you've made, and then there's not folks coming up and having that extra money to either go skiing, go golfing, and having disposable income, I think that contributed to that. So I just wanted to clarify that that also, those were factors I don't think that you needed to point out, but that I think we should, as a group, while we're making decisions, take into consideration. And with that, I'll leave it to the next.
Thank you. Members, we're running out of time. We want to bring up Commissioner Phillips as well. We've got a number of other people that would like to speak. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Noblezor, Ms. Hauer, I'm going to try and I'm going to only talk about Giants Ridge. And thank you, Representative Metza, for mentioning that it is a state resource. I have tried personally for years to try and deal with that debacle. I've been up against nothing but an iron wall, so thank you for your work. I now intend to dive in and correct this mess. We've spent tens of millions of dollars up there, unnecessarily so, and I'm totally disappointed to see how it's been mismanaged up there. I'm trying to look at your report, and I've spent some time looking at it. How will I really find out what the actual gross revenues of the operation are and how much we have spent and how much debt load is on there? Who's paying the debt load? How much, as Representative Anzell talked about, helping the good people up north and they're getting their property tax reduced, has it been funneled off to this operation when we've got examples around the Midwest where these operations have been sold to for-profit organizations, put back on the tax rolls, and have operated efficiently? This is absolutely embarrassing to have been any part of this, and I'm sorry to the state of Minnesota that I didn't push harder years ago to try and go after this. Do you have any idea? I mean, some of this I look at is amazing to me from a business model, to think that somebody operated this thing with expenses double of their revenue, not counting debt service and such, when they got competitors literally over the mountain or over the hill operating and making money. What in the world could you possibly, how could you possibly screw it up that bad? If this is an example that is so absolutely embarrassing, my goodness gracious, is this real that we've invested $20 million in capital investment? And oh my gosh, and we're in the middle, have they started to build the chalet yet? Is what, a multi-million dollar chalet? What's the return on the investment going to be for that? How many more people are going to ski there next year because they got a new $5 or $10 million chalet? Who did the analysis on that? I could go on and on and on. That's one little example. And I believe, doggone it, the ground's going to get broke in April. And we passed that bonding bill not when we were in control, I sure hope. And is that, let me just ask one question. Do you know, is that already, is the ground being broken on or that, or can we repeal those bonds and stop that debacle at least? Mr. Chair, if I could just say, and then however people want to answer, I want to dive into it, and I'd like to know, will I get information from you, and how much money information do you actually know? I know it wasn't a financial audit, or do I work through IRRRB to get the answers? Because I am going to dive into this. This is a responsibility between myself and Representative Garofalo to get answers. This has been a waste and an embarrassment for our state to operate this way with environment revenue that has been just, oh my goodness gracious. So did they really operate at like 50 cents on the dollar? The revenue is 50 cents of expenses, not counting debt service? Or am I missing something in your report?
Mr. Nobles. Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair, well, you posed a number of questions there, Representative McNamara.
Just answer the last one.
I couldn't tell you if it's 50 cents on the dollar. I know in gross terms what it meant, and it did mean that there was $17.4 million of operating loss over the 9-year period between 2006 and 2014. Yes, you asked the question about the new event center. The new event center may not be fully complete. I think that Commissioner Phillips can fill you in on the details there, but it was under construction last year, and I think it is supposed to be done for this coming season. In terms of the debt load, what we know is that over that same nine-year period, that in addition to the $17.4 million in operating loss that was covered by the subsidy, that there was $19.8 million paid for bond debt, and that there were an additional $6.7 million worth of capital investments in, over that same period. I think that you also asked, well, can you come to us, or can you do you have to go to the agency for more detailed data? I think that you will find more detailed data. We have some more detailed data, but obviously the agency is going to have everything that you need to ask. But to the extent we have data that could be useful to you, we will provide it.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Muginius.
Mr. Chair, two quick questions. On the first page, you say state agency, commissioner. What I didn't understand was, does the board have any control over the appointment of the commissioner, or is that solely done by the governor?
Ms. Howard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, it's a governor-appointed commissioner. It's the board does not appoint the commissioner. It is a governor-appointed commissioner.
Okay, and so...
And confirmed by the Senate.
Okay. Representative Wiginius.
Okay, confirmed by the Senate, not the board. That was trying...
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, correct.
Okay, that was one thing. The second thing is Representative Anzels brought up the Excelsior project. And I remember that debate really well. Representative McNamara thinks Giants Ridge is controversial. Excelsior was far more controversial. And so you said, and I will push back a little bit, you said that many people thought jobs would be created. There were a lot of people who said, nah, there are no jobs are going to be created here, because the fundamental flaw was that this was supposed to be a clean coal plant, and there was no science at the time that supported the ability to do clean coal. There was no engineering, no science. It was a, you know, you're going to, I don't know what it was. I don't want to characterize it. But with all the money that we spent over that, I think it was between 2002 and 6 or 7, so if you clarify that, did we ever get any of that money back?
Sauer?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wiginius, yes. The first loan was in 2002 worth $1.5 million. The second loan was in 2004 for $8 million. Very little of that has been repaid, but there have been a few repayments. But as of middle of last year, the balance for that $1.5 million was still $1.3 million. The balance on the $8 million was still $7.85 million. So obviously the bulk of those two loans has not been repaid.
Representative Guinness.
And there was federal money too? Was that
Sauer?
Did the federal get their money back?
Or? Mr. Chair, Representative Guinness. Yes, there was federal money. I think it was like $36 million in federal money, but I don't know the details on whether any of that was returned.
I think that would be interesting for us to know, just in terms of, was the federal government ahead of us in loans or behind us? That would be helpful to understand. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to talk to you with my back to you to get at the mic here. But first of all, I appreciate Representative Vansell's comments about the nature of the production tax and its use for local projects. But the analogy fails in one respect, because in cities and counties, when they're using local property tax for local projects, those decisions are made by the city council, by the county board, and so on. In the case of the metropolitan area, we've got the metropolitan council. State legislators are not allowed to sit on any of those, and so that touches on that constitutional aspect. My perspective on the IRRB has been kind of as a bystander. I've had a number of
relatives on the range and an occasion to be up there, so I'd hear talk. It's always been my impression that a large goal of it, aside from those local projects, is to help spur a diversified economy on the range so we can have job growth that will complement the mining jobs and provide a buffer against economic volatility like we've got this year and against the eventual playing out of any of the mines. And in that respect, I think we have to see that it has failed because we have not achieved that, although it's been going for many, many years. I know it's a long-term job, but I don't see progress. One of the things that I would have liked to have seen in the report is similar to Representative McNamara's comments. The most concrete thing of all we could see about the loan programs is what is the rate of repayment on these loans. I make microloans through Kiva around the world, $25 at a time, and that's what I'm looking at. You know, I'm looking for what is my repayment on those so it comes back into the fund so it can be recirculated back out and do more economic development. And I'm looking and I'm looking and I can't find it in the report. And so it's a relatively simple set of numbers. It wouldn't tell the whole story because it had to be broken out in all kinds of bits and pieces. But I don't see an overall how much money went out in loans and how much came back. You know, and that's kind of a really big piece of information to be missing here. Thank you.
Ms. Howard, do you have any of that comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did look at that on an individual loan basis for those 16 loans that were part of the loans that we reviewed. But you're right, that we did not report for that group of loans how much money went out. Well, we did report how much went out. We did not report for each one of those whether the loan had been repaid. And in some cases, repayment wasn't required. But you're right, in terms of a ratio, that was not part of this analysis.
Representative Russo.
Thank you. I'd be happy with just one total number for... But thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Thank you for your testimony, all one and all. It was very, very informative. We're going to bring Commissioner Phillips up now. I think Representative Metza has some questions and comments. Maybe the Commissioner has some comments as well. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Maybe I'll move that for a chair. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Phillips. I'm the commissioner at Iron Range Resources. I was appointed by the governor. I took the position mid-January of 2015, so I've been on the job a little over a year.
Very good. And members, we do have to hurry along because Representative Garofalo's committee is going to be meeting at 7:30, and there's people already filing in to attend that meeting, so we need to move right along. Please proceed.
I'll be real brief. So I have four observations just from the comments that I'll make, and then I'll talk about the Legislative Audit Commission. We came before and reacted to this report, so I'll mention that as well. So one thing, Representative Anzel commented on the distribution of taconite monies. So when the tax is paid, there is a formula distribution that goes back to cities, townships, school districts, and counties. Because that is legislated by formula, the residuals go into two accounts at IRRRB, primarily into a taconite environmental protection fund that is grants to communities, and into an environmental protection fund which goes for loans. But it's the residuals from the taconite taxes. And it operates essentially like a fiscal disparities thing, because these small towns that don't have a mine couldn't do large infrastructure projects. So I don't know, you know, the Met Council plays some of that role here in the metro area. We play a similar role. We're a lot like a port authority. So I don't know what kind of legislative oversight you have over, say, the St. Paul Port Authority. We do a lot of similar things that they do, but whatever. We are regularly financially audited. This was a program evaluation. So the questions on where money goes and how many loans and everything, I can get you our previous audits. And there's so, since somebody made the comment, and I'm not attributing any of these, that says, like, there's, we have to find out where the money is or that something bad happened. Everything happens in the light of day. So, and everything is accounted for and audited. So this is not an issue. The program evaluation, we appreciate. This is us getting better at evaluating our own programs, and I'll get to that in 1 second. But be clear, this is not a question of, this wasn't an audit. We have had many financial audits, and there's never been any findings about any money being missing at the IRRRB. Be clear about that. And then, as far as things being done in the light of day, so every year when we have a budget, we project the deficit at a place like Giants Ridge. And somebody mentions about $1.8 million a year, a little less than $2 million a year. And unfortunately, we probably haven't done a good job, and they pointed out, the legislator pointed out, is that we didn't have criteria and targets and know where we're at. So prior to them actually coming on the scene, when I got on the scene in January of 15, I said, we need to figure out what's going on here. I'd like to narrow these deficits. And one reason we have deficits, there was a conscious effort made to take some of the profit centers at a normal venue like this, so a private one. We put in private hands all the concessions of rentals and gift shops and things like that. So we need to account for those because they are economic impact. They employ people and there's money flowing back into the local economy. So we decided that we were going to commission a professionally done economic impact study. And this is important because we recently got the preliminary information back, and there's a couple of measures. One's a regular economic impact of the overall operation, and then they also separately looked at, was there any tax implications for the local jurisdictions, and then how much did that cost to deliver us services, okay? So out of our $1.9 million, there's about $2.7 million in direct tax payments from the Giants Ridge operation that goes back into local jurisdictions, school districts, cities, and county. And it cost them about $500,000 of that to provide us services. So there's about a net 2.2. So we're a little bit ahead of the game before we look at the economic impact of the place. So when we do this in the light of day every year, I know when the legislative auditor comes, he likes to add 10 years up and give you a hit between the eyes with a big number. But every year it's on the front page of our local newspaper. It's in the light of day. We approve the deficit of $1.9 million. This isn't hidden. This wasn't discovered by the legislative auditor or any auditor. This is done in the light of day. Having said that, so the preliminary numbers are, in addition to the $2.7 million, net $2.2 million of tax benefit, there's an economic impact of about $39 million a year from Giants Ridge puts on the regional economy up there. So this call to shut the place down, and it's an embarrassment and all that, I don't know. I just came on the scene. I'm looking forward, not back. I wasn't the commissioner when any of this went on. But I am telling you, as I look at it, it doesn't look like a bad investment to me. It's had over $40 million of private investment made up at the Hill and about $40 million of public investment in capital dollars. That was before the new chalet, so I give that. But so it's attracted a lot of private investment. And there's a lot more potential because the new housing area called Voyager's Retreat really opened right at the start of the housing crisis. So there's hundreds of lots over there. We think there'll be a lot more private tax money coming into our jurisdictions as a result of Giants Ridge. So now come to the legislative audit. The major things other than Giants Ridge were about us evaluating our programs. And when I got there, I appreciate this. I've told the legislative auditor we've embraced this report. I had a hard time doing exactly that. I said, I want to look at every program, including Giants Ridge, and say, how are we doing? How can we improve these? Can we quit doing some things? Can we start doing some new things? You know, I didn't think it was a stellar track record on economic development. We could do better. I've made a 35-year career out of economic development. I think I have some skills in this area. So we agree, and we've agreed to all the recommendations that we should have a starting point and ending point for every program and have a better way to evaluate them. Frankly, we were using surveying. I would say that we were in compliance with state business subsidy laws on every one of our transactions. So don't think we've been audited on that. So don't think that we broke any laws here. This isn't what they're helping us with is an evaluation tool on how well we can do our work and should we change, should we invest more or less in things. We're embracing that. We've already started. We've already engaged a consultant in a software. We're purchasing a software called Flux that's going to help our grants management and our evaluation of whether those grant programs work. We're just looking into the different softwares and programs available for our loan programs right now. The only one I pushed back a little bit with the auditor with, and they'll acknowledge this, was on the but for. I mean, we really want to loan money to people that aren't credit worthy. They can't get a bank loan, so they come to the government. We're not going to probably do that one, just so you know. But on majority of their recommendations, we're embracing them because they're going to help us evaluate our effectiveness. We've never been hiding out on any of these things. We want to get better. And they actually recommended a technique that maybe we can use unemployment insurance data, not identify individuals or anything like that. We can use that data to do the starting point and the ending point, and then we can evaluate our programs better. We weren't doing that. We were surveying the businesses. Now, on the other side of that is, though, so if we have a business that says they're going to create 10 jobs and they create 9, we need to know that. That's where I agree with the auditor. But are we going to pull their loan and put them out of business because they were short a job? I mean, some of this is common sense and reality, and I don't think we're lacking that at the agency, to be honest with you. We have a lot of really experienced people in our loans and our grant-making areas. I think they want to get better. They've embraced the report. The circus environment around, is this a scathing report or is this a blistering report? That's what I heard from the media. And I had a columnist from the Star Tribune that he must have read his article because that's what he said. Why isn't the place shut down? I don't know. $2 million a year, $40 million return. I don't know. I guess he was an ex-investment banker. He must know something I don't know. But I'd be happy to answer any questions I can answer.
No, we've got about 2 minutes. Representative Mezza.
Just so I get a chance to answer because he did point at me at some point.
Very quickly, Representative Mezza.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to clarify kind of what you said in regard to the Giants Ridge. So essentially what we have is something that costs us in terms of investment about $1.8 million a year in a projected deficit. And what we're gathering just from local property taxes and business taxes paid out in that area, specifically on the Giants Ridge footprint, we're bringing in around $500,000.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to be sure. We're bringing in $2.7 million approximately. It costs those jurisdictions services back to us about $500,000. The net result is about a net $2.2 million positive. Our deficit we're funding is about $1.8 or $1.9 million average.
And then on top of that, we have an additional impact of $38 million that benefits the entire region and all the surrounding communities.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's correct, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Phillips, I just want to clarify, I never once said that you should close it. Absolutely never once said you should close it. I'm dumbfounded that in all the years of operating there, you've never evaluated if it should be turned over to the private sector. That was my point of the whole argument. You've operated it so unbelievably lost, no private business would do that. You evidently don't know how to run a ski and a golf resort. And you're up here defending what you've done in the past. I would be much happier if you'd say, you know what, we have an open mind and are looking at how can we move forward in a positive way. I don't question the economic impact is good. The question is this the best way to spend the public's money, or would it be better to give tax relief to the hardworking people living on the range and let somebody in the ski and golf business run that? I have tried, and the delegation has jumped all over me for years, that leave us alone, we take care of our own. And now you come here telling me that I want to shut you down. That's not at all what I said. It's that kind of mentality that screws this whole place up. I said use a business model and an open mind to look at the operation. It's absolutely embarrassing. You want to come here and tell me the great economic impact, and you know what? You use the $1.9 million a year because it's advantageous. That's not the true losses recently. They've been going like this. 1.9 is the average for the last 10 years. They've been growing exponentially recently because of the downturn in golf and skiing. That's the reality. That's not your fault. That's the reality of the business that you probably shouldn't be in. And maybe somebody should be there. I don't know the answer to that. But I didn't base my talk on what some columnist wrote. Believe you me, those of us who have been around here as long as I have, don't base what we do on what somebody in whatever paper wrote about, whether it's myself, Representative Anzalk, or Representative Metza. And you and I got to get along, and we shouldn't talk about each other the way you just talked about me.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd apologize to Representative McNamara if he took offense to anything. I am looking forward. I've just spent a year long. We have a study which I'll provide to anybody here. We are trying to narrow those deficits as looking at in a business model sense. But the state gave away a lot of the profit centers to private entities, and we're over the next couple of years, we're going to try to pull those back in. Because we cannot get a model where we can get this into private hands until we stem these deficits. So I'm with you on that. We had it appraised, and the income approach, what do you think the answer was? No value. Is there some real estate value to the properties? Sure. Probably would be worth more if there was no buildings on them as hunting land or something, I don't know. But so we are trying to make this place into a business model that possibly could be spun off privately or could be operated long-term at a reasonable profit or minor deficit or whatever, as long as the economic impacts are so positive. So I'm with you. I'm looking forward. I am not looking back. I'm not proud of any past performance there or anything, but I'm being realistic. There has been a call for the place to be shut down. It didn't come from Representative McNamara, and I apologize, but there have been public calls, and I find it offensive that nobody wants to look at the facts, that they want to shoot from the hip.
What we're trying to do is get to the facts. Representative Russo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify that my remarks about wanting to know the stats about loan repayment were not a reflection of accounting principles or anything like that. It was about program evaluation and the effectiveness of the decisions that are made when the loans are granted.
Last question. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be very brief. Commissioner Phillips, thank you for being here. In your letter that's included at the back of the report, you addressed the six key recommendations you refer to them. The one thing you don't address in this letter is the constitutional question about the governance structure. That I didn't see that. If I missed it, I apologize, but what is your recommendation there?
Mr. Chairman, that wasn't in our legislative program evaluation. That was an appendix meant for the legislature, I believe. You'd have to ask Mr. Noble that, but it wasn't in our evaluation. There was no recommendations to us on that one, and that's why I didn't. I would say this. I operated in the 80s at the agency when it was advisory, and I'm operating now where it's the other way, and I haven't seen a lot of difference.
That take care of your question, Representative Fabian?
Well, Mr. Chair, thank you.
You were looking for your recommendation.
That's what I asked. Yeah. I said, what is your recommendation in terms of, I think the auditor has three different possible scenarios here. Is there one that you find that works within your governance structure to address the constitutional question?
Mr. Chairman, at a minimum, I think all the funds should require the governor's signature. I said I operated in the 80s when they were advisory to the commissioner. I wasn't the commissioner, but I've operated, worked there under that scenario, and I didn't find it offensive in any way. So,
thank you very much for your testimony. Members, I think it's been very enlightening, and we'll look forward to trying to come forward with some legislation to make some changes. Meeting adjourned.